11. We got to the dump around 1:30, and Vern led the way down the embankment with a paratroops over the side. We went to the bottom in big jumps and leaped over the brackish trickle of water oozing listlessly out of the culvert which poked out of the cinders. Beyond this small, boggy area was the sandy, trash-littered verge of the dump. There was a 6-foot security fence surrounding it. Every 20 feet, weather-faded signs were posted. They said, Castle Rock Dump, hours 4 to 8 p.m. Closed Mondays, trespassing strictly forbidden. We climbed to the top of the fence, swung over, and jumped down. Teddy and Vern led the way toward the well, which you tapped with an old-fashioned pump, the kind from which you had to call the water with elbow grease. There was a Crisco can filled with water next to the pump handle, and the great sin was to forget to leave it filled for the next guy to come along. The iron handle stuck off at an angle, looking like a one-winged bird that was trying to fly. It had once been green, but almost all of the paint had been rubbed off by the thousands of hands that had worked that handle since 1940. The dump is one of my strongest memories of Castle Rock. It always reminds me of the surrealist painters when I think of it. Those fellows who were always painting pictures of clock faces lying limply in the crotches of trees, or Victorian living rooms standing in the middle of the Sahara, or steam engines coming out of fireplaces. To my child's eye, nothing in the Castle Rock dump looked as if it really belonged there. We had entered from the back. If you came in from the front, a wide dirt road came in through the gate, broadened out into a semicircular area that had been bulldozed as flat as a dirt landing strip, and then ended abruptly at the edge of the dumping pit. The pump, Teddy and Vern were currently standing there and squabbling about who was going to prime it, was at the back of this great pit. It was maybe 80 feet deep, and filled with all the American things that get empty, wear out, or just don't work anymore. There was so much stuff that my eyes hurt just looking at it. Or maybe it was your brain that actually hurt, because it could never quite decide what your eye should stop on. Then your eye would stop, or be stopped, by something that seemed as out of place as those limp clock faces or the living room in the desert. A brass bedstead leaning drunkenly in the sun. A little girl's dolly looking amazedly between her thighs as she gave birth to stuffing. An overturned Studebaker automobile with its chrome bullet nose glittering in the sun like some Buck Rogers missile. One of those giant water bottles they have in office buildings, transformed by the summer sun into a hot, blazing sapphire. There was plenty of wildlife there, too, although it wasn't the kind you see in the Walt Disney nature films or at those tame zoos where you can pet the animals. Plump rats. Woodchucks grown sleek and lumbering on such rich chow as rotting hamburger and maggoty vegetables, seagulls by the thousands and stalking among the gulls like thoughtful, introspective ministers, an occasional huge crow. It was also the place where the town's stray dogs came for a meal when they couldn't find any trash cans to knock over or any deer to run. They were a miserable, ugly-tempered mongrel lot. Slat-sided and grinning bitterly, they would attack each other over a fly-blown piece of bologna or a pile of chicken guts fuming in the sun. But these dogs never attacked Milo Pressman, the dumpkeeper, because Milo was never without Chopper at his heel. Chopper was, at least until Joe Camber's dog Cujo went rabid 20 years later, the most feared and least seen dog in Castle Rock. He was the meanest dog for 40 miles around, or so we'd heard, and ugly enough to stop a striking clock. The kids whispered legends about Chopper's meanness. Some said he was half German Shepherd, some said he was mostly Boxer, and a kid from Castle View with the unfortunate name of Harry Hoare claimed that Chopper was a Doberman Pinscher whose vocal cords had been surgically removed so you couldn't hear him when he was on the attack. There were other kids who claimed Chopper was a maniacal Irish wolfhound, and Milo Pressman fed him a special mixture of Gaines meal and chicken blood. These same kids claimed that Milo didn't dare take Chopper out of his shack unless the dog was hooded like a hunting falcon. The most common story was that Pressman had trained Chopper not just to sick, but to sick specific parts of the human anatomy. Thus, an unfortunate kid who had illegally scaled the dump fence to pick up illicit treasures might hear Milo Pressman cry, "Chopper, sick, hand!" and Chopper would grab that hand and hold on, ripping skin and tendons, powdering bones between his slavering jaws, until Milo told him to quit. It was rumored that Chopper could take an ear, an eye, a foot, or a leg, and that a second offender, who was surprised by Milo and the ever-loyal Chopper, would hear the dread cry, "Chopper! Sick! Balls!" And that kid would be a soprano for the rest of his life. Milo himself was more commonly seen and thus more commonly regarded. He was just a half-bright working Joe who supplemented his small-town salary by fixing things people threw away and selling them around town. There was no sign of either Milo or Chopper today. Chris and I watched Vern prime the pump while Teddy worked the handle frantically. At last he was rewarded with a flood of clear water. A moment later, both of them had their heads under the trough, Teddy still pumping away a mile a minute. "Teddy's crazy," I said softly. "Oh, yeah," Chris said matter-of-factly. "He won't live to be twice the age he is now, I bet. His dad burning his ears like that, that's what did it. He's crazy to dodge trucks the way he does. He can't see worth a shit, glasses or no glasses. You remember that time in the tree?" "Yeah." The year before, Teddy and Chris had been climbing the big pine tree behind my house. They were almost to the top, and Chris said they couldn't go any further because all of the branches up there were rotten. Teddy got that crazy, stubborn look on his face and said fuck that, he had pine tar all over his hands, and he was going to go up until he could touch the top. Nothing Chris said could talk him out of it. So up he went, and he actually made it. He only weighed 75 pounds or so, remember. He stood there, clutching the top of that pine in one tar-gummy hand, shouting that he was king of the world or some stupid thing like that, and then there was a sickening, rotted crack as the branch he was standing on gave way and he plummeted. What happened next was one of those things that make you sure there must be a god. Chris reached out, purely on reflex, and what he caught was a fistful of Teddy Duchamp's hair. And although his wrist swelled up fat and he was unable to use his right hand very well for almost 2 weeks, Chris held him until Teddy, screaming and cursing, got his foot on a live branch thick enough to support his weight. Except for Chris's blind grab, he would have turned and crashed and smashed all the way to the foot of the tree, 120 feet below. When they got down, Chris was gray-faced and almost puking with the fear reaction, and Teddy wanted to fight him for pulling his hair. They would have gone at it, too, if I hadn't been there to make peace. "I dream about that every now and then," Chris said, and looked at me with strangely defenseless eyes. "Except in this dream I have, I always miss him. I just get a couple of hairs, and Teddy screams, and down he goes." "Weird, huh?" "Weird," I agreed. And for just one moment we looked in each other's eyes and saw some of the true things that made us friends. Then we looked away again and watched Teddy and Vern throwing water at each other, screaming and laughing and calling each other pussies. "Yeah, but you didn't miss him," I said. "Chris Chambers never misses. Am I right?" "Not even when the ladies leave the seat down," he said. He winked at me, formed an O with his thumb and forefinger, and spat a neat white bullet through it. "Eat me raw, Chambers," I said. "Through a flavor straw," he said, and we grinned at each other. Vern yelled, "Come on and get your water before it runs back down the pipe." "Race you," Chris said. "In this heat, you're off your gourd." "Come on," he said, still grinning. "On my go." "Okay, go!" We raced, our sneakers digging up the hard, sun-baked dirt, our torsos leaning out ahead of our flying, blue-jeaned legs, our fists doubled. It was a dead heat, with both Vern on Chris's side and Teddy on mine holding up their middle fingers at the same moment. We collapsed, laughing in the still, smoky odor of the place, and Chris tossed Vern his canteen. When it was full, Chris and I went to the pump, and first Chris pumped for me, and then I pumped for him, the shockingly cold water sluicing off the soot and heat all in a flash, sending our suddenly freezing scalps 4 months ahead into January. Then I refilled the lard can, and we all walked over to sit down in the shade of the dump's only tree, a stunted ash 40 feet from Milo Pressman's tar-paper shack. The tree was hunched slightly to the west, as if what it really wanted to do was pick up its roots the way an old lady would pick up her skirts and just get the hell out of the dump. "The most," Chris said, laughing, tossing his tangled hair back from his brow. "A blast," I said. nodding, still laughing myself. "This is really a good time," Vern said simply, and he didn't just mean being off limits inside the dump, or fudging our folks, or going on a hike up the railroad tracks into Harlow. He meant those things, but it seems to me now that there was more, and that we all knew it. Everything was there and around us. We knew exactly who we were, and exactly where we were going. It was grand. We sat under the tree for a while, shooting the ship like we always did. Who had the best ball team? Still the Yankees, with Mantle and Maris, of course. What was the best car? 55 Thunderbird, with Teddy holding out stubbornly for the 58 Corvette. Who was the toughest guy in Castle Rock who wasn't in our gang? We all agreed it was Jamie Gallant, who gave Mrs. Ewing the finger and then sauntered out of her class with his hands in his pockets while she shouted at him. The best TV show? Either The Untouchables or Peter Gunn. Both Robert Stack as Elliot Ness and Craig Stevens as Gunn were cool. All that stuff. It was Teddy who first noticed that the shade of the ash tree was getting longer, and asked me what time it was. I looked at my watch and was surprised to see it was 2:15. "Hey, man," Vern said, "somebody's got to go for provisions. Dump opens at 4. I don't want to still be here when Milo and Chopper make the scene." Even Teddy agreed. He wasn't afraid of Milo, who had a pot belly and was at least 40, but every kid in Castle Rock squeezed his balls between his legs when Chopper's name was mentioned. "Okay," I said. "Odd man goes?" "That's you, Gordy," Chris said, smiling. "Odd as a cod." "So's your mother," I said, and gave them each a coin. "Flip." 4 coins glittered up into the sun. 4 hands snatched them from the air. 4 flat smacks on 4 grimy wrists. We uncovered. 2 heads and 2 tails. We flipped again, and this time all 4 of us had tails.
"Oh, Jesus, that's a goocher," Vern said, not telling us anything we didn't know.
4 heads, or a moon, was supposed to be extraordinarily good luck. 4 tails was a goocher, and that meant very bad luck.
"Fuck that shit," Chris said. "It doesn't mean anything. Go again."
"No, man," Vern said earnestly. "A goocher, that's really bad. You remember when Clint Bracken and those guys got wiped out on Seroy Hill in Durham? Billy told me they was flipping for beers, and they came up a goocher just before they got into the car, and bang, they all got fucking totaled."
"I don't like that, sincerely."
"Nobody believes that crap about moons and goochers," Teddy said impatiently. "It's baby stuff. Vern, you gonna flip or not?" Vern flipped, but with obvious reluctance. This time he, Chris, and Teddy all had tails. I was showing Thomas Jefferson on a nickel, and I was suddenly scared. It was as if a shadow had crossed some inner sun. They still had a goocher, all 3 of them, as if dumb fate had pointed at them a second time. Abruptly, I thought of Chris saying, "I just get a couple of hairs," and Teddy screams and down he goes. Weird, huh? 3 tails, 1 head. Then Teddy was laughing his crazy, cackling laugh, and pointing at me, and the feeling was gone. "I heard that only fairies laugh like that," I said, and gave him the finger.
"Hee-hee-hee, Gordy," Teddy laughed.
"Go get the provisions, you fucking Morphidite." I wasn't really sorry to be going. I was rested up and didn't mind going down the road to the Florida market. "Don't call me any of your mother's pet names," I said to Teddy.
"Hee-hee-hee, what a fucking wet you are, LaChance."
"Go on, Gordy," Chris said. "We'll wait over by the tracks." "You guys better not go without me," I said. Vern laughed. "Going without you would be like going with Schlitz instead of Budweiser's, Gordy."
"Ah, shut up," they chanted together. "I don't shut up, I grow up, and when I look at you, I throw up."
"Then your mother goes around the corner and licks it up," I said, and hauled ass out of there, giving them the finger over my shoulder as I went. I never had any friends later on like the ones I had when I was 12. Jesus, did you? 12. Different strokes for different folks, they say now. And that's cool. So if I say summer to you, you get one set of private, personal images that are all the way different from mine. That's cool. But for me, summer is always going to mean running down the road to the Florida market with change jingling in my pockets, the temperature in the gay 90s, my feet dressed in Keds. The word conjures an image of the GS&WM railroad tracks running into a perspective point in the distance, burnished so white under the sun
that when you closed your eyes, you could still see them there in the dark, only blue instead of white. But there was more to that summer than our trip across the river to look for Ray Brower, although that looms the largest. Sounds of the Fleetwood singing Come Softly to Me, and Robin Luke singing Susie Darlin', and little Anthony popping the vocal on I Ran All the Way Home. Were they all hits in that summer of 1960? Yes and no. Mostly yes. In the long purple evenings when rock and roll from WLAM blurred into night baseball from WCOU, time shifted. I think it was all 1960, and that the summer went on for a space of years, held magically intact in a web of sounds, the sweet hum of crickets, the machine gun roar of playing cards riffling against the spokes of some kid's bicycle as he pedaled home for a late supper of cold cuts and iced tea, the flat Texas voice of Buddy Knox singing, Come along and be my party doll and I'll make love to you, and the baseball announcer's voice, mingling with the song and with the smell of freshly cut grass. Count three and two now, Whitey Ford leans over, shakes off the sign, now he's got it. Ford pauses, pitches, and there it goes. Williams got all of that one. Kiss it goodbye. Red Sox lead 3-1. Was Ted Williams still playing for the Red Sox in 1960? You bet your ass he was. 3-16 for my man Ted. I remember that very clearly. Baseball had become important to me in the last couple of years, ever since I'd had to face the knowledge that baseball players were as much flesh and blood as I was. That knowledge came when Roy Campanella's car overturned, and the papers screamed mortal news from the front pages. His career was done. He was going to sit in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. How that came back to me, with that same sickening mortal thud, when I sat down to this typewriter one morning 2 years ago, turned on the radio, and heard that Thurman Munson had died while trying to land his airplane. There were movies to go see at the Gem, which has long since been torn down. Science fiction movies like Gog with Richard Egan, and westerns with Audie Murphy. Teddy saw every movie Audie Murphy made at least three times. He believed Murphy was almost a god. And war movies with John Wayne. There were games and endless bolted meals, lawns to mow, places to run to, walls to pitch pennies against, people to clap you on the back. And now I sit here trying to look through an IBM keyboard and see that time, trying to recall the best and worst of that green and brown summer, and I can almost feel the skinny, scabbed boy still buried in this advancing body, and hear those sounds. But the apotheosis of the memory and the time is Gordon LaChance running down the road to the Florida market with change in his pockets and sweat running down his back. I asked for 3 pounds of hamburger and got some hamburger rolls, 4 bottles of Coke, and a 2-cent church key to open them with. The owner, a man named George Dussett, got the meat and then leaned by his cash register, one hammy hand planted on the counter by the big bottle of hard-cooked eggs, a toothpick in his mouth, his huge beer belly rounding his white T-shirt like a sail filled with a good wind. He stood right there as I shopped, making sure I didn't try to hawk anything. He didn't say a word until he was weighing up the hamburger. I know you. You're Denny LaChance's brother, ain't you? The toothpick journeyed from one corner of his mouth to the other as if on ball bearings. He reached behind the cash register, picked up a bottle of Soke cream soda, and chugged it. Yes, sir, but Denny, he... Yeah, I know. That's a sad thing, kid. The Bible says, in the midst of life, we are in death. Did you know that? Yeah. I lost a brother in Korea. You look just like Denny. People ever tell you that? Yeah, spitting image. Yes, sir, sometimes, I said glumly. I remember the year he was all conference. Halfback he played, yeah. Could he run? Father God and Sonny Jesus, you're probably too young to remember. He was looking over my head out through the screen door and into the blasting heat, as if he were having a beautiful vision of my brother. I remember. Mr. Dussett? What, kid? His eyes were still misty with memory. The toothpick trembled a little between his lips. Your thumb is on that scales. What? He looked down, astounded, to where the ball of his thumb was pressed firmly on the white enamel. If I hadn't moved away from him a little bit when he started talking about Dennis, the ground meat would have hidden it.
Why?
So it is, yeah. I guess I just got thinking about your brother. God love him. George Dussett signed a cross on himself. When he took his thumb off the scales, the needle sprang back 6 ounces. He patted a little more meat on top and then did the package up with white butcher's paper.
Okay, he said, past the toothpick. Let's see what we got here. 3 pounds of hamburg, that's $1.44. Hamburg rolls, that's 27. 4 sodas, 40 cents. 1 church key, 2 pence. Comes to, he added it up on the bag he was going to put the stuff in, 2.29.
13, I said. He looked up at me very slowly, frowning.
Huh?
2.13, you added it wrong.
Kid, are you... You added it wrong, I said. First you put your thumb on the scales, and then you overcharged on the groceries, Mr. Dussett. I was going to throw some Hostess Twinkies on top of that order, but now I guess I won't.
I spanged $2.13 down on the Schlitz placemat in front of him. He looked at the money, then at me. The frown was now tremendous, the lines on his face as deep as fissures.
What are you, kid? He said in a low voice that was ominously confidential. Are you some kind of smartass?
No, sir, I said. But you ain't going to jap me and get away with it. What would your mother say if she knew you was japping little kids?
He thrust our stuff into the paper bag with quick, stiff movements, making the Coke bottles clink together. He thrust the bag at me, roughly, not caring if I dropped it and broke the sodas or not. His swarthy face was flushed and dull, the frown now frozen in place.
Okay, kid, here you go. Now what you do is you get the Christ out of my store. I see you in here again and I'm going to throw you out, me. Yeah, smart-ass little son of a whore.
I won't come in again, I said, walking over to the screen door and pushing it open. The hot afternoon buzzed somnolently along its appointed course outside, sounding green and brown and full of silent light.
Neither will none of my friends. I guess I got 50 or so.
Your brother wasn't no smartass, George Dussett yelled.
Fuck you, I yelled and ran like hell down the road.
I heard the screen door bang open like a gunshot, and his bull roar came after me.
If you ever come in here again, I'll fat your lip for you, you little punk.
I ran until I was over the first hill, scared and laughing to myself, my heart beating out a trip hammer pulse in my chest. Then I slowed to a fast walk, looking back over my shoulder every now and then to make sure he wasn't going to take after me in his car or anything. He didn't, and pretty soon I got to the dump gate. I put the bag inside my shirt, climbed the gate, and monkeyed down the other side. I was halfway across the dump area when I saw something I didn't like. Milo Pressman's portholed 56 Buick was parked behind his tar paper shack. If Milo saw me, I was going to be in a world of hurt. As yet, there was no sign of either him or the infamous chopper, but all at once the chain-link fence at the back of the dump seemed very far away. I found myself wishing I'd gone around the outside, but I was now too far into the dump to want to turn around and go back. If Milo saw me climbing the dump fence, I'd probably be in Dutch when I got home, but that didn't scare me as much as Milo yelling for chopper to sick would. Scary violin music started to play in my head. I kept putting one foot in front of the other, trying to look casual, trying to look as if I belonged here with a paper grocery sack poking out of my shirt, heading for the fence between the dump and the railroad tracks. I was about 50 feet from the fence, and just beginning to think that everything was going to be all right after all, when I heard Milo shout,
"Hey! Hey, you! Kid! Get away from that fence! Get out of here!"
The smart thing to have done would have been to just agree with the guy and go around. But by then I was so keyed that instead of doing the smart thing, I just broke for the fence with a wild yell, my sneakers kicking up dust. Vern, Teddy, and Chris came out of the underbrush on the other side of the fence and stared anxiously through the chain link.
"You come back here," Milo bawled. "Come back here or I'll sick my dog on you, God damn it!"
I did not exactly find that to be the voice of sanity in conciliation, and I ran even faster for the fence, my arms pumping, the brown grocery bag crackling against my skin. Teddy started to laugh his idiotic chortling laugh, hee-hee-hee, into the air like some reed instrument being played by a lunatic.
"Go, Gordy, go!" Vern screamed, and Milo yelled, "Sick him, chopper! Go get him, boy!"
I threw the bag over the fence, and Vern elbowed Teddy out of the way to catch it.
Behind me, I could hear Chopper coming, shaking the earth, blurting fire out of one distended nostril and ice out of the other, dripping sulfur from his champing jaws. I threw myself halfway up the fence with one leap, screaming. I made it to the top in no more than 3 seconds and simply leaped. I never thought about it, never even looked down to see what I might land on. What I almost landed on was Teddy, who was doubled over and laughing like crazy. His glasses had fallen off and tears were streaming out of his eyes. I missed him by inches and hit the clay gravel embankment just to his left. At the same instant, Chopper hit the chain-link fence behind me and let out a howl of mingled pain and disappointment. I turned around, holding one skinned knee, and got my first look at the famous Chopper, and my first lesson in the vast difference between myth and reality. Instead of some huge hellhound with red, savage eyes and teeth jutting out of his mouth like straight pipes from a hot rod, I was looking at a medium-sized mongrel dog that was a perfectly common black and white. He was yapping and jumping fruitlessly, going up on his back legs to paw the fence. Teddy was now strutting up and down in front of the fence, twiddling his glasses in one hand and inciting Chopper to ever greater rage. "Kiss my ass, Choppy," Teddy invited, spittle flying from his lips. "Kiss my ass! Bite shit!" He bumped his fanny against the chain-link fence, and Chopper did his level best to take Teddy up on his invitation. They got nothing for his pains but a good, healthy nose bump. He began to bark crazily, foam flying from his snout. Teddy kept bumping his rump against the fence, and Chopper kept lunging at it, always missing, doing nothing but racking out his nose, which was now bleeding. Teddy kept exhorting him, calling him by the somehow grisly diminutive Choppy, and Chris and Vern were lying weakly on the embankment, laughing so hard that they could now do little more than wheeze. And here came Milo Pressman, dressed in sweat-stained fatigues and a New York Giants baseball cap, his mouth drawn down in distracted anger. "Here, here," he was yelling. "You boys stop a-teasing that dog, you hear me? Stop it right now! Bite it, Choppy!" Teddy yelled, strutting up and down on our side of the fence like a mad Prussian reviewing his troops. "Come on and sick me! Sick me!" Chopper went nuts. I mean it sincerely. He ran around in a big circle, yelping and barking and foaming, rear feet spewing up tough little dry clods. He went around about 3 times, getting his courage up, I guess, and then he launched himself straight at the security fence. He must have been going 30 miles an hour when he hit it, I kid you not. His doggy lips were stretched back from his teeth, and his ears were flying in the slipstream. The whole fence made a low, musical sound as the chain link was not just driven back against the posts, but sort of stretched back. It was like a zither note. A strangled yawp came out of Chopper's mouth. Both eyes came up blank, and he did a totally amazing reverse snap roll, landing on his back with a solid thump that sent dust puffing up around him. He just lay there for a moment, and then he crawled off with his tongue hanging crookedly from the left side of his mouth. At this, Milo himself went almost berserk with rage. His complexion darkened to a scary plum color. Even his scalp was purple under the short hedgehog bristles of his flat-top haircut. Sitting stunned in the dirt, both knees of my jeans torn out, my heart still thudding from the nearness of my escape, I thought that Milo looked like a human version of Chopper. "I know you," Milo raved. "You're Teddy Duchamp. I know all of you. Sonny, I'll beat your ass teasing my dog like that." "Like to see you try," Teddy raved right back. "Let's see you climb over this fence and get me, fat ass." "What? What did you call me?" "Fat ass," Teddy screamed happily. "Lard bucket, tub of guts, come on, come on." He was jumping up and down, fists clenched, sweat flying from his hair. "Teach you to sick your stupid dog on people, come on. Like to see you try." "You little tin weasel peckerwood loony's son, I'll see your mother gets an invitation to go down and talk to the judge in court about what you done to my dog." "What did you call me?" Teddy asked hoarsely. He had stopped jumping up and down. His eyes had gone huge and glassy, and his skin was the color of lead. Milo had called Teddy a lot of things, but he was able to go back and get the one that had struck home with no trouble at all. Since then, I have noticed again and again what a genius people have for that, for finding the loony button down inside, and not just pressing it, but hammering on the fucker.
Your dad was a loony, he said, grinning. Loony up in Togus, that's what. Crazier than a shithouse rat. Crazier than a buck with tickwood fever. Nuttier than a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. Loony. No wonder you're acting the way you are with a loony for a... Your mother blows dead rats, Teddy screamed. And if you call my dad a loony again, I'll fucking kill you, you cocksucker.
Loony, Milo said smugly. He'd found the button, all right. Looney's kid, Looney's kid. Your father's got toys in the attic, kid. Tough break.
Vern and Chris had been getting over their laughing fit, perhaps getting ready to appreciate the seriousness of the situation and call Teddy off. But when Teddy told Milo that his mother blew dead rats, they went back into hysterics again, lying there on the bank, rolling from side to side, their feet kicking, holding their bellies.
No more, Chris said weakly. No more, please, no more. I swear to God, I'm going to bust.
Chopper was walking around in a large, dazed figure eight behind Milo. He looked like the losing fighter about 10 seconds after the ref has ended the match and awarded the winner a TKO. Meanwhile, Teddy and Milo continued their discussion of Teddy's father, standing nose to nose with the wire fence Milo was too old and too fat to climb between them.
Don't you say anything else about my dad. My dad stormed the beach at Normandy, you fucking wet end. Yeah. Well, where is he now, you ugly little four-eyed turd? He went up to Togus, ain't he? He's up to Togus because he went fucking Section 8.
Okay, that's it, Teddy said. That's it. That's the end. I'm going to kill you.
He threw himself at the fence and started up.
You come on and try it, you slimy little bastard.
Milo stood back, grinning and waiting.
No, I shouted. I got to my feet, grabbed Teddy by the loose seat of his jeans, and pulled him off the fence. We both staggered back and fell over, him on top.
He squashed my balls pretty good, and I groaned. Nothing hurts like having your balls squashed, you know it, but I kept my arms locked around Teddy's middle.
Let me up, Teddy sobbed, writhing in my arms. Let me up, Gordy. Nobody ranks out my old man. Let me up, goddammit, let me up! That's just what he wants, I shouted in his ear. He wants you to get over there and beat the piss out of you and then take you to the cops. Huh?
Teddy craned around to look at me, his face dazed.
Never mind your smart mouth, kid, Milo said, advancing to the fence again with his hands curled into ham-sized fists. Let him fight his own battles.
Sure, I said. You only outweigh him by 500 pounds.
I know you, too, Milo said ominously. Your name's LeChance.
He pointed to where Vern and Chris were finally picking themselves up, still breathing fast from laughing so hard.
And those guys are Chris Chambers and one of those stupid Tessio kids. All your fathers are going to get calls from me except for the loony up to Togus. You'll go to the reformatory, every one of you, juvenile delinquents.
He stood flat on his feet, big freckled hands held out like a guy who wanted to play one potato, two potato, breathing hard, eyes narrow, waiting for us to cry or say we were sorry or maybe give him Teddy so he could feed Teddy to Chopper. Chris made an O out of his thumb and index finger and spat neatly through it. Vern hummed and looked at the sky. Teddy said, "Come on, Gordy, let's get away from this asshole before I puke."
Oh, you're going to get it, you foul-mouthed little whoremaster. Wait till I get you to the constable.
We heard what you said about his father, I told him. We're all witnesses. And you sicked that dog on me. That's against the law.
Milo looked a trifle uneasy.
You was trespassing.
The hell I was, the dump's public property.
You climbed the fence...
Sure I did after you sicked your dog on me, I said,
hoping that Milo wouldn't recall that I'd also climbed the gate to get in.
What did you think I was going to do, stand there and let him rip me to pieces? Come on, you guys, let's go. It stinks around here.
Formatory, Milo promised hoarsely, his voice shaking. Formatory for you wise guys.
Can't wait to tell the cops how you called a war vet a fucking loony, Chris called back over his shoulder as we moved away.
What did you do in the war, Mr. Pressman?
None of your damn business, Milo shrieked. You hurt my dog.
Put it on your TS slip and send it to the chaplain, Vern muttered.
And then we were climbing the railroad embankment again.
Come back here, Milo shouted.
But his voice was fainter now, and he seemed to be losing interest. Teddy shot him the finger as we walked away. I looked back over my shoulder when we got to the top of the embankment. Milo was standing there behind the security fence, a big man in a baseball cap with his dog sitting beside him. His fingers were hooked through the small chain-link diamonds as he shouted at us. and all at once I felt very sorry for him. He looked like the biggest third grader in the world, locked inside the playground by mistake, yelling for someone to come and let him out. He kept on yelling for a while, and then he either gave up or we got out of range. No more was seen or heard of Milo Pressman and Chopper that day. 13. There was some discussion, in righteous tones that were actually kind of forced-sounding, about how we had shown that creepy Milo Pressman we weren't just another bunch of pussies. I told how the guy at the Florida market had tried to jap us, and then we fell into a gloomy silence, thinking it over. For my part, I was thinking that maybe there was something to that stupid Gucci business after all. Things couldn't have turned out much worse. In fact, I thought it might be better to just keep going and spare my folks the pain of having one son in the Castle View Cemetery and one in South Windham Boys Correctional. I had no doubt that Milo would go to the cops as soon as the importance of the dump having been closed at the time of the incident filtered into his thick skull. When that happened, he would realize that I really had been trespassing, public property or not. Probably that gave him every right in the world to sic his stupid dog on me. And while Chopper wasn't the hellhound he was cracked up to be, he sure would have ripped the sit-down out of my jeans if I hadn't won the race to the fence. All of it put a big dark crimp in the day. And there was another gloomy idea rolling around inside my head, the idea that this was no lark after all, and maybe we deserved our bad luck. Maybe it was even God warning us to go home. What were we doing, anyway? Going to look at some kid that had gotten himself all mashed up by a freight train? But we were doing it, and none of us wanted to stop. We had almost reached the trestle which carried the tracks across the river when Teddy burst into tears. It was as if a great inner tidal wave had broken through a carefully constructed set of mental dikes. No bullshit. It was that sudden and that fierce. The sobs doubled him over like punches, and he sort of collapsed into a heap, his hands going from his stomach to the mutilated gobs of flesh that were the remains of his ears. He went on crying in hard, violent bursts. None of us knew what the fuck to do. It wasn't crying like when you got hit by a line drive while you were playing shortstop, or smashed on the head playing tackle football on the common, or when you fell off your bike. There was nothing physically wrong with him. We walked away a little and watched him, our hands in our pockets. "Hey, man," Vern said in a very thin voice. Chris and I looked at Vern hopefully. "Hey, man" was always a good start, but Vern couldn't follow it up. Teddy leaned forward onto the cross ties and put a hand over his eyes. Now he looked like he was doing the Allah bit. Salami, salami, baloney, as Popeye says, except it wasn't funny. At last, when the force of his crying had trailed off a little, it was Chris who went to him. He was the toughest guy in our gang, maybe even tougher than Jamie Gallant, I thought privately, but he was also the guy who made the best peace. He had a way about it. I'd seen him sit down on the curb next to a little kid with a scraped knee, a kid he didn't even fucking know, and get him talking about something, the Shrine Circus that was coming to town, or Huckleberry Hound on TV, until the kid forgot he was supposed to be hurt. Chris was good at it. He was tough enough to be good at it. "Listen, Teddy, what do you care what a fat old pile of shit like him said about your father? Huh? I mean, sincerely. That don't change nothing, does it? What a fat old pile of shit like him says, huh? Huh? Does it?" Teddy shook his head violently. It changed nothing. But to hear it spoken of, in bright daylight, something he must have gone over and over in his mind while he was lying awake in bed and looking at the moon off-center in one window pane, something he must have thought of in his slow and broken way until it seemed almost holy, trying to make sense out of it, and then to have it brought home to him, that everybody else had merely dismissed his dad as a loony, that had rocked him. But it changed nothing. Nothing. "He still stormed the beach at Normandy, right?" Chris said. He picked up one of Teddy's sweaty, grimy hands and patted it. Teddy nodded fiercely, crying. Snot was running out of his nose. "Do you think that pile of shit was at Normandy?" Teddy shook his head violently. No. Do you think that guy knows you? No, but... Or your father? He one of your father's buddies? No! Angry, horrified. The thought. Teddy's chest heaved, and more sobs came out of it. He had pushed his hair away from his ears, and I could see the round, brown, plastic button of the hearing aid set in the middle of his right one. The shape of the hearing aid made more sense than the shape of his ear, if you get what I mean. Chris said calmly, "Talk is cheap." Teddy nodded, still not looking up. "And whatever's between you and your old man, talk can't change that." Teddy's head shook, without definition, unsure if this was true. Someone had redefined his pain, and redefined it in shockingly common terms. That would, loony, have to be examined fucking Section 8 later, in depth, on long, sleepless nights. Chris rocked him. "He was ranking you, man," he said in soothing cadences that were almost a lullaby. "He was trying to rank you over that friggin' fence, you know it? No strain, man, no fucking strain. He don't know nothing about your old man. He don't know nothing but stuff he heard from those rum-dums down at the Mellow Tiger. He's just dog shit, man. Right, Teddy? Huh? Right?" Teddy's crying was down to sniffles. He wiped his eyes, leaving two sooty rings around them, and sat up. "I'm okay," he said, and the sound of his own voice seemed to convince him. "Yeah, I'm okay." He stood up and put his glasses back on, dressing his naked face, it seemed to me. He laughed thinly and swiped his bare arm across the snot of his upper lip. "Fucking crybaby, right?" "No, man," Vern said uncomfortably. "If anyone was ranking out my dad, then you gotta kill 'em," Teddy said briskly, almost arrogantly. "Kill their asses, right, Chris?" "Right," Chris said amiably, and clapped Teddy on the back. "Right, Gordy?" "Absolutely," I said, wondering how Teddy could care so much for his dad when his dad had practically killed him, and how I couldn't seem to give much of a shit one way or another about my own dad, when so far as I could remember he had never laid a hand on me since I was 3 and got some bleach from under the sink and started to eat it. We walked another 200 yards down the tracks, and Teddy said in a quieter voice, "Hey, if I spoiled your good time, I'm sorry. I guess that was pretty stupid shit back there at the fence." "I ain't sure I want it to be no good time," Vern said suddenly. Chris looked at him. "You saying you want to go back, man?" "No, uh-uh." Vern's face nodded in thought. "But going to see a dead kid, it shouldn't be a party, maybe. I mean, if you can dig it. I mean..." He looked at us rather wildly. "I mean, I could be a little scared, if you get me." Nobody said anything, and Vern plunged on. "I mean, sometimes I get nightmares, like... Oh, you guys remember the time Danny Naughton left that pile of old funny books, the ones with the vampires and people getting cut up and all that shit? Jeez and crow. I wake up in the middle of the night dreaming about some guy hanging in a house with his face all green or something, you know, like that. And it seems like there's something under the bed, and if I dangled a hand over the side, that thing might, you know, grab me." We all began to nod. We knew about the night shift. I would have laughed then, though, if you had told me that one day, not too many years from then, I'd parlay all those childhood fears and night sweats into about $1 million. "And I don't dare say anything, because my friggin' brother, well, you know Billy, he'll broadcast it." He shrugged miserably. "So I'm scared to look at that kid, because if he's, you know, if he's really bad..." I swallowed and glanced at Chris. He was looking gravely at Vern and nodding for him to go on. "If he's really bad," Vern resumed, "I'll have nightmares about him, and wake up thinking it's him under my bed, all cut up in a pool of blood like he just came out of one of those Salad Master gadgets they show on TV, just eyeballs and hair, but moving somehow, if you can dig that, moving somehow, you know, and getting ready to grab." "Jesus Christ," Teddy said thickly. "What a fucking bedtime story." "Well, I can't help it," Vern said, his voice defensive. "But I feel like we have to see him, even if there are bad dreams, you know? Like, we have to. But maybe it shouldn't be no good time." "Yeah," Chris said softly. "Maybe it shouldn't." Vern said pleadingly, "You won't tell none of the other guys, will you? I don't mean about the nightmares. Everybody has those. I mean about waking up and thinking there might be something under the bed.
I'm too fucking old for the boogeyman.
We all said we wouldn't tell, and a glum silence fell over us again. It was only 2:45, but it felt much later. It was too hot, and too much had happened. We weren't even over into Harlow yet. We were going to have to pick them up and lay them down if we were going to make some real miles before dark. We passed the railroad junction and a signal on a tall, rusty pole, and all of us paused to chuck cinders at the steel flag on top, but nobody hit it. And around 3:30, we came to the Castle River and the GS&WM trestle, which crossed it. 14. The river was better than 100 yards across at that point in 1960. I've been back to look at it since then and found it had narrowed up quite a bit during the years between. They're always fooling with the river, trying to make it work better for the mills, and they've put in so many dams that it's pretty well tamed. But in those days, there were only 3 dams on the whole length of the river as it ran across New Hampshire and half of Maine. The castle was still almost free back then, and every third spring it would overflow its banks and cover Route 136 in either Harlow or Danvers Junction or both. Now, at the end of the driest summer western Maine had seen since the Depression, it was still broad. From where we stood on the Castle Rock side, the bulking forest on the Harlow side looked like a different country altogether. The pines and spruces over there were bluish in the heat haze of the afternoon. The rails went across the water 50 feet up, supported by an underpinning of tarred wooden support posts and crisscrossing beams. The water was so shallow you could look down and see the tops of the cement plugs, which had been planted 10 feet deep in the riverbed to hold up the trestle. The trestle itself was pretty chintzy. The rails ran over a long, narrow wooden platform of 6x4s. There was a 4-inch gap between each pair of these beams where you could look all the way down into the water. On the sides, there was no more than 18 inches between the rail and the edge of the trestle. If a train came, it was maybe enough room to avoid getting plastered, but the wind generated by a high-balling freight would surely sweep you off to fall to a certain death against the rocks just below the surface of the shallow running water. Looking at the trestle, we all felt fear start to crawl around in our bellies, and mixing uneasily with the fear was the excitement of a boss dare, a really big one, something you could brag on for weeks after you got home. If you got home. That queer light was creeping back into Teddy's eyes, and I thought he wasn't seeing the GS&WM train trestle at all, but a long sandy beach, 1,000 LSTs aground in the foaming waves, 10,000 GIs charging up the sand, combat boots digging. They were leaping rolls of barbed wire, tossing grenades at pillboxes, overrunning machine gun nests. We were standing beside the tracks, where the cinders sloped away toward the river's cut, the place where the embankment stopped and the trestle began. Looking down, I could see where the slope started to get steep. The cinders gave way to scraggly, tough-looking bushes and slabs of gray rock. Further down, there were a few stunted firs with exposed roots writhing their way out of fissures in the plates of rock. They seemed to be looking down at their own miserable reflections in the running water. At this point, the Castle River actually looked fairly clean. At Castle Rock, it was just entering Maine's textile mill belt. But there were no fish jumping out there, although the river was clear enough to see bottom. You had to go another 10 miles upstream and toward New Hampshire before you could see any fish in the castle. There were no fish, and along the edges of the river you could see dirty collars of foam around some of the rocks. The foam was the color of old ivory. The river's smell was not particularly pleasant either. It smelled like a laundry hamper full of mildewy towels. Dragonflies stitched at the surface of the water and laid their eggs with impunity. There were no trout to eat them. Hell, there weren't even any shiners. Man, Chris said softly. Come on, Teddy said in that brisk, arrogant way. Let's go. He was already edging his way out, walking on the 6x4s between the shining rails. Say, Vern said uneasily, any of you guys know when the next train's due? We all shrugged. I said, there's the Route 136 bridge. Hey, come on, give me a break, Teddy cried. That means walking 5 miles down the river on this side and then 5 miles back up on the other side. It'll take us until dark. If we use the trestle, we can get to the same place in 10 minutes. But if a train comes, there's nowheres to go, Vern said. He wasn't looking at Teddy.
He was looking down at the fast, bland river. "Fuck, there isn't," Teddy said indignantly. He swung over the edge and held one of the wooden supports between the rails. He hadn't gone out very far. His sneakers were almost touching the ground. But the thought of doing that same thing above the middle of the river with a 50-foot drop beneath and a train bellowing by just over my head, a train that would probably be dropping some nice hot sparks into my hair and down the back of my neck, none of that actually made me feel like Queen for a day. "See how easy it is?" Teddy said. He dropped to the embankment, dusted his hands, and climbed back up beside us. "You telling me you're going to hang on that way if it's a 200-car freight?" Chris asked. "Just sort of hang there by your hands for 5 or 10 minutes? "You chicken?" Teddy shouted. "No, just ask him what you'd do," Chris said, grinning. "Peace, man." "Go around if you want to," Teddy brayed. "Who gives a fuck? I'll wait for you. I'll take a nap." "One train already went by," I said reluctantly. "And there probably isn't any more than 1-2 trains a day that go through Harlow. Look at this." I kicked the weeds growing up through the railroad ties with one sneaker. There were no weeds growing between the tracks which ran between Castle Rock and Lewiston. "There, see?" Teddy, triumphant. "But still, there's a chance," I added. "Yeah," Chris said. He was looking only at me, his eyes sparkling. "Dare you, a chance. Dares go first." "Okay," Chris said. He widened his gaze to take in Teddy and Vern. "Any pussies here?" "No," Teddy shouted. Vern cleared his throat, croaked, cleared it again, and said, "No," in a very small voice. He smiled a weak, sick smile. "Okay," Chris said. But we hesitated for a moment, even Teddy, looking warily up and down the tracks. I knelt down and took one of the steel rails firmly in my hand, never minding that it was almost hot enough to blister the skin. The rail was mute. "Okay," I said. And as I said it, some guy pole-vaulted in my stomach. He dug his pole all the way into my balls, it felt like, and ended up sitting astride my heart. We went out onto the trestle, single file. Chris first, then Teddy, then Vern, and me playing tail-end Charlie because I was the one who said dares go first. We walked on the platform cross-ties between the rails, and you had to look at your feet whether you were scared of heights or not. A misstep, and you would go down to your crotch, probably with a broken ankle to pay. The embankment dropped away beneath me, and every step further out seemed to seal our decision more firmly, and to make it feel more suicidally stupid. I stopped to look up when I saw the rocks giving way to water far beneath me. Chris and Teddy were a long way ahead, almost out over the middle, and Vern was tottering slowly along behind them, peering studiously down at his feet. He looked like an old lady trying out stilts, with his head poked downward, his back hunched, his arms held out for balance. I looked back over my shoulder. Too far, man. I had to keep going now, and not only because a train might come. If I went back, I'd be a pussy for life. So I got walking again. After looking down at that endless series of crossties for a while, with a glimpse of running water between each pair, I started to feel dizzy and disoriented. Each time I brought my foot down, part of my brain assured me it was going to plunge through into space, even though I could see it was not. I became acutely aware of all the noises inside me and outside me, like some crazy orchestra tuning up to play. The steady thump of my heart, the blood beat in my ears like a drum being played with brushes, the creak of sinews like the strings of a violin that has been tuned radically upward, the steady hiss of the river, the hot hum of a locust digging into tight bark, the monotonous cry of a chickadee, and somewhere, far away, a barking dog. Chopper, maybe. The mildewy smell of the Castle River was strong in my nose. The long muscles in my thighs were trembling. I kept thinking how much safer it would be, probably faster as well, if I just got down on my hands and knees and scuttered along that way. But I wouldn't do that. None of us would. If the Saturday matinee movies down at the Gem had taught us anything, it was that only losers crawl. It was one of the central tenets of the gospel according to Hollywood. Good guys walk firmly upright. And if your sinews are creaking like overtuned violin strings because of the adrenaline rush going on in your body, and if the long muscles in your thighs are trembling for the same reason, Why, so be it. I had to stop in the middle of the trestle and look up at the sky for a while. That dizzy feeling had been getting worse. I saw phantom cross ties. They seemed to float right in front of my nose. Then they faded out, and I began to feel okay again. I looked ahead and saw I had almost caught up with Vern, who was slow-poking along worse than ever. Chris and Teddy were almost all the way across. And although I've since written 7 books about people who can do such exotic things as read minds and precognite the future, that was when I had my first and last psychic flash. I'm sure that's what it was. How else to explain it? I squatted and made a fist around the rail on my left. It thrummed in my hand. It was thrumming so hard that it was like gripping a bundle of deadly metallic snakes. You've heard it said, his bowels turned to water. I know what that phrase means. Exactly what it means. It may be the most accurate cliché ever coined. I've been scared since. Badly scared, but I've never been as scared as I was in that moment holding that hot live rail. It seemed that for a moment all my works below throat level just went limp and lay there in an internal faint. A thin stream of urine ran listlessly down the inside of one thigh. My mouth opened. I didn't open it. It opened by itself. The jaw dropping like a trap door from which the hinge pins had suddenly been removed. My tongue was plastered suffocatingly against the roof of my mouth. All my muscles were locked. That was the worst. My works went limp, but my muscles were in a kind of dreadful lock bolt, and I couldn't move at all. It was only for a moment, but in the subjective time stream, it seemed forever. All sensory input became intensified, as if some power surge had occurred in the electrical flow of my brain, cranking everything up from 110 volts to 220. I could hear a plane passing in the sky somewhere near and had time to wish I was on it, just sitting in a window seat with a Coke in my hand and gazing idly down at the shining line of a river whose name I did not know. I could see every little splinter and gouge in the tarred cross-tie I was squatting on, and out of the corner of my eye I could see the rail itself with my hand still clutched around it, glittering insanely. The vibration from that rail sank so deeply into my hand that when I took it away it still vibrated, the nerve endings kicking each other over and over again, tingling the way a hand or foot tingles when it has been asleep and is starting to wake up. I could taste my saliva, suddenly all electric and sour and thickened to curds along my gums. And worst, somehow most horrible of all, I couldn't hear the train yet. Could not know if it was rushing at me from ahead or behind or how close it was. It was invisible. It was unannounced, except for that shaking rail. There was only that to advertise its imminent arrival, an image of Ray Brower, dreadfully mangled and thrown into a ditch somewhere like a ripped-open laundry bag, reeled before my eyes. We would join him, or at least Vern and I would, or at least I would. We had invited ourselves to our own funerals. The last thought broke the paralysis, and I shot to my feet. I probably would have looked like a jack-in-the-box to anyone watching, but to myself I felt like a boy in underwater slow motion, shooting up not through 5 feet of air, but rather up through 500 feet of water, moving slowly, moving with a dreadful languidness as the water parted grudgingly. But at last I did break the surface. I screamed, "Train!" The last of the paralysis fell from me, and I began to run. Vern's head jerked back over his shoulder. The surprise that distorted his face was almost comically exaggerated, written as large as the letters in a Dick and Jane primer. He saw me break into my clumsy, shambling run, dancing from one horribly high cross-tie to the next, and knew I wasn't joking. He began to run himself. Far ahead, I could see Chris stepping off the ties and onto the solid, safe embankment, and I hated him with a sudden, bright green hate, as juicy and as bitter as the sap in an April leaf. He was safe. That fucker was safe. I watched him drop to his knees and grab a rail. My left foot almost slipped into the yaw beneath me. I flailed with my arms, my eyes as hot as ball bearings in some runaway piece of machinery, got my balance, and ran on. Now I was right behind Vern. We were past the halfway point, and for the first time I heard the train. It was coming from behind us, coming from the Castle Rock side of the river. It was a low, rumbling noise that began to rise slightly and sort itself into the diesel thrum of the engine and the higher, more sinister sound of big, grooved wheels turning heavily on the rails. "Aw, shit!" Vern screamed. "Run, you pussy!" I yelled and thumped him on the back. "I can't! I'll fall! Run faster! Aw, shit!" But he ran faster, a shambling scarecrow with a bare, sunburnt back, the collar of his shirt swinging and dangling below his butt. I could see the sweat standing out on his peeling shoulder blades, standing out in perfect little beads. I could see the fine down on the nape of his neck, his muscles clenched and loosened, clenched and loosened, clenched and loosened. His spine stood out in a series of knobs, each knob casting its own crescent-shaped shadow. I could see that these knobs grew closer together as they approached his neck. He was still holding his bedroll, and I was still holding mine. Vern's feet thudded on the cross ties. He almost missed one, lunged forward with his arms out, and I whacked him on the back again to keep him going. "Gordy, I can't! Oh, shit! Run faster, dickface," I bellowed. And I was enjoying this? Yeah. In some peculiar, self-destructive way that I have experienced since only when completely and utterly drunk, I was. I was driving Vern Tessio like a drover getting a particularly fine cow to market. And maybe he was enjoying his own fear in that same way, bawling like that self-same cow, hollering and sweating, his ribcage rising and falling like the bellows of a blacksmith on a speed trip, clumsily keeping his footing, lurching ahead. The train was very loud now, its engine deepening to a steady rumble. Its whistle sounded as it crossed the junction point where we had paused to chuck cinders at the rail flag. I had finally gotten my hellhound, like it or not. I kept waiting for the trestle to start shaking under my feet. When that happened, it would be right behind us. "Go faster, Vern! Faster! Oh, God, Gordy! Oh, God, Gordy! Oh, shit! The freight's electric horn suddenly spanked the air into 100 pieces with one long, loud blast, making everything you ever saw in a movie or a comic book or one of your own daydreams fly apart, letting you know what both the heroes and the cowards really heard when death flew at them. Wonk! Wonk! And then Chris was below us and to the right, and Teddy was behind him, his glasses flashing back arcs of sunlight, and they were both mouthing a single word, and the word was jump. But the train had sucked all the blood out of the word, leaving only its shape in their mouths. The trestle began to shake as the train charged across it. We jumped. Vern landed full length in the dust and the cinders, and I landed right beside him, almost on top of him. I never did see that train, nor do I know if its engineer saw us. When I mentioned the possibility that he hadn't seen us to Chris a couple of years later, he said, "They don't blow the horn like that just for chucks, Gordy." But he could have. He could have been blowing it just for the hell of it, I suppose. Right then, such fine points didn't much matter. I clapped my hands over my ears and dug my face into the hot dirt as the freight went by, metal squalling against metal, the air buffeting us. I had no urge to look at it. It was a long freight, but I never looked at all. Before it had passed completely, I felt a warm hand on my neck. I knew it was Chris's. When it was gone, when I was sure it was gone, I raised my head like a soldier coming out of his foxhole at the end of a day-long artillery barrage. Vern was still plastered into the dirt, shivering. Chris was sitting cross-legged between us, one hand on Vern's sweaty neck, the other still on mine. When Vern finally sat up, shaking all over and licking his lips compulsively, Chris said, "What do you guys think if we drink those Cokes? Can anybody use one besides me?" We all thought we could use one. About a quarter of a mile along on the Harlow side, the GS and WM tracks plunged directly into the woods. The heavily wooded land sloped down to a marshy area. It was full of mosquitoes, almost as big as fighter planes, but it was cool, blessedly cool.
We sat down in the shade to drink our Cokes. Vern and I threw our shirts over our shoulders to keep the bugs off, but Chris and Teddy just sat naked to the waist, looking as cool and collected as two Eskimos in an ice house. We hadn't been there 5 minutes when Vern had to go off into the bushes and take a squat, which led to a good deal of joking and elbowing when he got back. Train scare you much, Vern?
No,
Vern said. I was going to squat when we got across anyway. I had to take a squat, you know.
Vern,
Chris and Teddy chorused.
Come on, you guys, I did, sincerely.
Then you won't mind if we examine the seat of your jockeys for Hershey squirts, will you? Teddy asked. And Vern laughed, finally understanding that he was getting ribbed.
Go screw.
Chris turned to me. That train scare you, Gordy?
Nope,
I said and sipped my Coke.
Not much, you sucker, he punched my arm.
Sincerely, I wasn't scared at all.
Yeah? You wasn't scared?
Teddy was looking me over carefully.
No, I was fucking petrified.
This slew all of them, even Vern, and we laughed long and hard. Then we just lay back, not goofing anymore, just drinking our Cokes and being quiet. My body felt warm, exercised, at peace with itself. Nothing in it was working cross-grained to anything else. I was alive and glad to be. Everything seemed to stand out with a special dearness, and although I never could have said that out loud, I didn't think it mattered. Maybe that sense of dearness was something I wanted just for myself. I think I began to understand a little bit that day what makes men become daredevils. I paid $20 to watch Evel Knievel attempt his jump over the Snake River Canyon a couple of years ago, and my wife was horrified. She told me that if I'd been born a Roman, I would have been right there in the Colosseum munching grapes and watching as the lions disemboweled the Christians. She was wrong, although it was hard for me to explain why, and really I think she thought I was just driving her. I didn't cough up that 20 to watch the man die on coast-to-coast closed-circuit TV. Although I was quite sure that was exactly what was going to happen. I went because of the shadows that are always somewhere behind our eyes, because of what Bruce Springsteen calls the darkness on the edge of town in one of his songs. And at one time or another, I think everyone wants to dare that darkness in spite of the jalopy bodies that some joker of a god gave us human beings. No, not in spite of our jalopy bodies, but because of them.
Hey, tell that story, Chris said, suddenly sitting up.
What story, I asked, although I guess I knew. I always felt uncomfortable when the talk turned to my stories, although all of them seemed to like them, wanting to tell stories, even wanting to write them down. That was just peculiar enough to be sort of cool, like wanting to grow up to be a sewer inspector or a Grand Prix mechanic. Richie Jenner, a kid who hung around with us until his family moved to Nebraska in 1959, was the first one to find out that I wanted to be a writer when I grew up, that I wanted to do that for my full-time job. We were up in my room, just fooling around, and he found a bunch of handwritten pages under the comic books in a carton in my closet.
What's this? Richie asks.
Nothing, I say, and try to grab them back. Richie held the pages up out of reach, and I must admit that I didn't try very hard to get them back. I wanted him to read them, and at the same time I didn't. An uneasy mix of pride and shyness that has never changed in me very much when someone asks to look. The act of writing itself is done in secret, like masturbation. Oh, I have one friend who has done things like write stories in the display windows of bookshops and department stores, but this is a man who is nearly crazy with courage, the kind of man you'd like to have with you if you just happened to fall down with a heart attack in a city where no one knew you. For me, it always wants to be sex and always falls short. It's always that adolescent hand job in the bathroom with the door locked. Richie sat right there on the edge of my bed for most of the afternoon, reading his way through the stuff I had been doing, most of it influenced by the very same sort of comic books as the ones that had given Vern nightmares. And when he was done, Richie looked at me in a strange new way that made me feel very peculiar, as if he had been forced to reappraise my whole personality. He said, "You're pretty good at this. Why don't you show these to Chris?" I said, "No, I wanted it to be a secret." And Richie said, "Why? It ain't pussy. You ain't no queer. I mean, it ain't poetry." Still, I made him promise not to tell anybody about my stories. And, of course, he did.
and it turned out most of them liked to read the stuff I wrote, which was mostly about getting buried alive or some crook coming back from the dead and slaughtering the juries that had condemned him in 12 interesting ways, or a maniac that went crazy and chopped a lot of people into veal cutlets before the hero, Kurt Cannon, cut the subhuman screeching madman to pieces with round after round from his smoking 45 automatic. In my stories, there were always rounds, never bullets. For a change of pace, there were the Ledillo stories. Ledillo was a town in France, and during 1942, a grim squad of tired American dog faces were trying to retake it from the Nazis. This was 2 years before I discovered that the Allies didn't land in France until 1944. They went on trying to retake it, fighting their way from street to street, through about 40 stories, which I wrote between the ages of 9 and 14. Teddy was absolutely mad for the Ledillo stories, and I think I wrote the last dozen or so just for him. By then I was heartily sick of Ledillo and writing things like Mon Dieu and Cherchez la Boche and Fermez la Porte. In Ledillo, French peasants were always hissing to GI dog faces to Fermez la Porte. But Teddy would hunch over the pages, his eyes big, his brow beaded with sweat, his face twisting. There were times when I could almost hear air-cooled Brownings and whistling 88s going off in his skull. The way he clamored for more Ledillo stories was both pleasing and frightening. Nowadays, writing is my work, and the pleasure has diminished a little, and more often that guilty, masturbatory pleasure has become associated in my head with the coldly clinical images of artificial insemination. I come according to the rules and regs laid down in my publishing contract. And although no one is ever going to call me the Thomas Wolfe of my generation, I rarely feel like a cheat. I get it off as hard as I can every fucking time. Doing less would, in an odd way, be like going faggot, or what that meant to us back then. What scares me is how often it hurts these days. Back then I was sometimes disgusted by how damn good it felt to write. These days, I sometimes look at this typewriter and wonder when it's going to run out of good words. I don't want that to happen. I guess I can stay cool as long as I don't run out of good words, you know. What's this story? Vern asked uneasily. It ain't a horror story, is it, Gordy? I don't think I want to hear no horror stories. I'm not up for that, man. No, it ain't a horror, Chris said. It's really funny. Gross, but funny. Go on, Gordy, hammer that fucker to us. Is it about Ledillo? Teddy asked. No, it ain't about Ledillo, you psycho, Chris said, and Rabbit punched him. It's about this pie-eating contest. Hey, I didn't even write it down yet, I said. Yeah, but tell it. You guys want to hear it? Sure, Teddy said. Boss. Well, it's about this made-up town. Gretna, I call it. Gretna, Maine. Gretna? Vern said, grinning. What kind of name is that? There ain't no Gretna in Maine. Shut up, fool, Chris said. He just told you it was made up, didn't he? Yeah, but Gretna, that sounds pretty stupid. Lots of real towns sound stupid, Chris said. I mean, what about Alfred, Maine, or Saco, Maine, or Jerusalem's Lot, or Castle Fucking Rock? There ain't no castle here. Most town names are stupid. You just don't think so because you're used to them, right, Gordy? Sure, I said. But privately, I thought Vern was right. Gretna was a pretty stupid name for a town. I just hadn't been able to think of another one. So, anyway, they're having their annual Pioneer Days, just like in Castle Rock. Yeah, Pioneer Days, that's a fucking blast, Vern said earnestly. I put my whole family in that jail on wheels they have, even fucking Billy. It was only for half an hour, and it cost me my whole allowance, but it was worth it just to know where the son of a whore was. Will you shut up and let him tell it? Teddy hollered. Vern blinked. Sure, yeah. Okay. Go on, Gordy, Chris said. It's not really much. Nah, we don't expect much from a wet end like you, Teddy said, but tell it anyway. I cleared my throat. So, anyway, it's Pioneer Days, and on the last night they have these three big events. There's an egg roll for little kids and a sack race for kids that are like 8 or 9, and then there's the pie-eating contest. And the main guy of the story is this fat kid nobody likes named Davy Hogan. Like Charlie Hogan's brother if he had one, Vern said, and then shrank back as Chris Rabbit punched him again. This kid, he's our age, but he's fat. He weighs like 180, and he's always getting beat up and ranked out. And all the kids, instead of calling him Davy, they call him Lard-Ass Hogan and rank him out whenever they get the chance. They nodded respectfully, showing the proper sympathy for Lardass, although if such a guy ever showed up in Castle Rock, we all would have been out teasing him and ranking him to the dogs and back. So he decides to take revenge, because he's like fed up, you know. He's only in the pie-eating contest, but that's like the final event during Pioneer Days, and everyone really digs it. The prize is $5. So he wins it and gives a finger to everybody, Teddy said. Boss! No, it's better than that, Chris said. Just shut up and listen. Lardass figures to himself, $5, what's that? If anybody remembers anything at all in 2 weeks, it'll just be that fucking pig Hogan out-ate everybody. Well, it figures. Let's go over to his house and rank the shit out of him. Only now we'll call him Pie-Ass instead of Lardass. They nodded some more, agreeing that Davy Hogan was a thinking cat. I began to warm to my own story. But everybody expects him to enter the contest, you know. Even his mom and dad. Hey, they practically got that $5 spent for him already. Yeah, right, Chris said. So he's thinking about it, and hating the whole thing, because being fat isn't really his fault. See, he's got these weird fucking glands something, and my cousin's like that, Vern said excitedly. Sincerely, she weighs close to 300 pounds. Supposed to be hyoid gland or something like that. I don't know about her hyoid gland, but what a fucking blimp. No shit. She looks like a fucking Thanksgiving turkey. And this one time... Will you shut the fuck up, Vern? Chris cried violently. For the last time, honest to God. He had finished his Coke, and now he turned the hourglass-shaped green bottle upside down and brandished it over Vern's head. Yeah, right. I'm sorry. Go on, Gordy. It's a swell story. I smiled. I didn't really mind Vern's interruptions, but of course I couldn't tell Chris that. He was the self-appointed guardian of art. So he's turning it over in his mind, you know, the whole week before the contest. At school, kids keep coming up to him and saying, Hey, Lardass, how many pies you gonna eat? You gonna eat 10? 20? Fucking 80? And Lardass, he says, How should I know? I don't even know what kind they are. And see, there's quite a bit of interest in the contest because the champ is this grown-up whose name is, Bill Traynor, I guess. And this guy Traynor, he ain't even fat. In fact, he's a real string bean, but he can eat pies like a whiz, and the year before he ate 6 pies in 5 minutes. Whole pies? Teddy asked, awestruck. Right you are. And Lardass, he's the youngest guy to ever be in the contest. Go, Lardass! Teddy cried excitedly. Scoff up those fucking pies. Tell him about the other guys in it, Chris said. Okay. Besides Lardass Hogan and Bill Traynor, there was Calvin Speer, the fattest guy in town. He ran the jewelry store. Gretna Jewels, Vern said, and snickered. Chris gave him a black look. And then there's this guy who's a disc jockey at a radio station up in Lewiston. He ain't exactly fat, but he's sort of chubby, you know. And the last guy was Hubert Gretna III. It was the principal of Lardass Hogan's school. He was eating against his own principal? Teddy asked. Chris clutched his knees and rocked back and forth joyfully. Ain't that great? Go on, Gordy. I had them now. They were all leaning forward. I felt an intoxicating sense of power. I tossed my empty Coke bottle into the woods and scrunched around a little bit to get comfortable. I remember hearing the chickadee again, off in the woods, farther away now, lifting its monotonous, endless call into the sky. Dee, 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 dee. So he gets this idea, I said. The greatest revenge idea a kid ever had. The big night comes, the end of Pioneer Days. The pie-eating contest comes just before the fireworks. The main street of Gretna has been closed off so people can walk around in it, and there's this big platform set up right in the street. There's bunting hanging down and a big crowd in front. There's also a photographer from the paper to get a picture of the winner with blueberries all over his face, because it turned out to be blueberry pies that year. Also, I almost forgot to tell you this, they had to eat their pies with their hands tied behind their backs. So, dig it. They come up onto the platform. 16. From The Revenge of Lardass Hogan by Gordon LaChance. Originally published in Cavalier Magazine, March 1975. Used by permission. They came up onto the platform one by one and stood behind a long trestle table covered with a linen cloth. The table was stacked high with pies and stood at the edge of the platform. Above it were looped necklaces of bare 100-watt bulbs, moths and night flyers banging softly against them and haloing them. Above the platform, bathed in spotlights, was a long sign which read, The Great Gretna Pie Eat of 1960.
To either side of this sign hung battered loudspeakers supplied by Chuck Day of the Great Day Appliance Shop. Bill Travis, the reigning champion, was Chuck's cousin. As each contestant came up, his hands bound behind him and his shirt front open, like Sidney Carton on his way to the guillotine, Mayor Charbonneau would announce his name over Chuck's PA system and tie a large white bib around his neck. Calvin Speer received token applause only. In spite of his belly, which was the size of a 20-gallon water barrel, he was considered an underdog, second only to the Hogan Kid. Most considered Lardass a comer, but too young and inexperienced to do much this year. After Speer, Bob Cormier was introduced. Cormier was a disc jockey who did a popular afternoon program at WLAM in Lewiston. He got a bigger hand, accompanied by a few screams from the teenage girls in the audience. The girls thought he was cute. John Wiggins, principal of Gretna Elementary School, followed Cormier. He received a hearty cheer from the older section of the audience and a few scattered boos from the fractious members of his student body. Wiggins managed to beam paternally and frown sternly down on the audience at the same time. Next, Mayor Charbonneau introduced Lardass.
A new participant in the annual Great Gretna Pie Eat, but one we expect great things from in the future, young Master David Hogan.
Lardass got a big round of applause as Mayor Charbonneau tied on his bib, and as it was dying away, a rehearsed Greek chorus, just beyond the reach of the 100-watt bulbs, cried out in wicked unison,
"Go get 'em, Lardass!"
There were muffled shrieks of laughter, running footsteps, a few shadows that no one could or would identify, some nervous laughter, some judicial frowns, the largest from His Honor Charbonneau, the most visible figure of authority. Lardass himself appeared not to even notice. The small smile greasing his thick lips and creasing his thick chops did not change as the mayor, still frowning largely, tied his bib around his neck and told him not to pay any attention to fools in the audience, as if the mayor had even the faintest inkling of what monstrous fools Lardass Hogan had suffered and would continue to suffer as he rumbled through life like a Nazi tiger tank. The mayor's breath was warm and smelled of beer. The last contestant to mount the bunting-decorated stage drew the loudest and most sustained applause. This was the legendary Bill Travis, 6 feet 5 inches tall, gangling, voracious. Travis was a mechanic at the local Amoco station down by the rail yard, a likable fellow if there ever was one. It was common knowledge around town that there was more involved in the Great Gretna Pie Eat than a mere $5. At least for Bill Travis, there was. There were two reasons for this. First, people always came by the station to congratulate Bill after he won the contest. And most everyone who came to congratulate stayed to get his gas tank filled. And the two garage bays were sometimes booked up for a solid month after the contest. Folks would come in to get a muffler replaced or their wheel bearings greased, and would sit in the theater chairs ranged along one wall. Jerry Molling, who owned the Amoco, had salvaged them from the old Gem Theater when it was torn down in 1957, drinking Cokes and Moxies from out of the machine and gassing with Bill about the contest as he changed spark plugs or rolled around on a crawly wheelie under someone's International Harvester pickup, looking for holes in the exhaust system. Bill always seemed willing to talk, which was one of the reasons he was so well-liked in Gretna. There was some dispute around town as to whether Jerry Molling gave Bill a flat bonus for the extra business his yearly feat, or yearly eat if you prefer, brought in, or if he got an out-and-out raise. Whatever way it was, there could be no doubt that Travis did much better than most small-town wrench jockeys. He had a nice-looking two-story ranch out on the Sabattis Road, and certain snide people referred to it as the house that Pies built. That was probably an exaggeration. But Bill had it coming another way, which brings us to the second reason there was more in it for Travis than just $5. The Pie Eat was a hot wagering event in Gretna. Perhaps most people only came to laugh, but a goodly minority also came to lay their money down. Contestants were observed and discussed by these bettors as ardently as thoroughbreds are observed and discussed by racing touts. The wagerers accosted contestants' friends, relatives, even mere acquaintances. They pried out any and all details concerning the contestants' eating habits. There was always a lot of discussion about that year's official pie. Apple was considered a heavy
pie. Apricot, a light one, although a contestant had to resign himself to a day or two of the trots after downing 3 or 4 apricot pies. That year's official pie, blueberry, was considered a happy medium. Bettors, of course, were particularly interested in their man's stomach for blueberry dishes. How did he do on blueberry buckle? Did he favor blueberry jam over strawberry preserves? Had he been known to sprinkle blueberries on his breakfast cereal? Or was he strictly a bananas and cream sort of fella? There were other questions of some moment. Was he a fast eater who slowed down, or a slow eater who started to speed up as things got serious, or just a good, steady, all-around trencherman? How many hot dogs could he put away while watching a Babe Ruth League game down at the St. Tom's baseball field? Was he much of a beer drinker? And if so, how many bottles did he usually put away in the course of an evening? Was he a belcher? It was believed that a good belcher was a bit tougher to beat over the long haul. All of this and other information was sifted, the odds laid, the bets made. How much money actually changed hands during the week or so following pie night, I have no way of knowing. But if he held a gun to my head and forced me to guess, I'd put it at close to $1,000. That probably sounds like a pretty paltry figure, but it was a lot of money to be passing around in such a small town 15 years ago. And because the contest was honest, and a strict time limit of 10 minutes was observed, no one objected to a competitor betting on himself. And Bill Travis did so every year. Talk was, as he nodded, smiling to his audience on that summer night in 1960, that he had bet a substantial amount on himself again, and that the best he had been able to do this year was 1 for 5 odds. If you're not the betting type, let me explain it this way. He'd have to put $250 at risk to win 50. Not a good deal at all, but it was the price of success. And as he stood there, soaking up the applause and smiling easy, he didn't look too worried about it. "And the defending champion," Mayor Charbonneau trumpeted, "Gretna's own Bill Travis." "Ooh, Bill, how many are you going through tonight, Bill? You going for 10, Billy boy? I got a 2-spot on you, Bill. Don't let me down, boy. Save me one of those pies, Trav." Nodding and smiling with all proper modesty, Bill Travis allowed the mayor to tie his bib around his neck. Then he sat down at the far right end of the table, near the place where Mayor Charbonneau would stand during the contest. From right to left them, the eaters were Bill Travis, David Lardass Hogan, Bob Cormier, Principal John Wiggins, and Calvin Speer holding down the stool on the far left. Mayor Charbonneau introduced Sylvia Dodge, who was even more of a contest figure than Bill Travis himself. She had been president of the Gretna Ladies Auxiliary for years beyond telling, since the first Manassas, according to some town wits. And it was she who oversaw the baking of each year's pies, strictly subjecting each to her own rigorous quality control, which included a weigh-in ceremony on Mr. Banchichek's butcher scales down at the Freedom Market. This to make sure that each pie weighed within an ounce of the others. Sylvia smiled regally down at the crowd, her blue hair twinkling under the hot glow of the light bulbs. She made a short speech about how glad she was that so much of the town had turned out to celebrate their hardy pioneer forebears, the people who made this country great. For it was great, not only on the grassroots level where Mayor Charbonneau would be leading the local Republicans to the hallowed seats of town government again in November, but on the national level, where the team of Nixon and Lodge would take the torch of freedom from our great and beloved general and hold it high for... Calvin Speer's belly rumbled noisily. Warp. There was laughter, and even some applause. Sylvia Dodge, who knew perfectly well that Calvin was both a Democrat and a Catholic, either would have been forgivable alone, but the two combined, never, managed to blush, smile, and look furious, all at the same time. She cleared her throat and wound up with a ringing exhortation to every boy and girl in the audience, telling them to always hold the red, white, and blue high, both in their hands and in their hearts, and to remember that smoking was a dirty, evil habit which made you cough. The boys and girls in the audience, most of whom would be wearing peace medallions and smoking not camels but marijuana in another 8 years, shuffled their feet and waited for the action to begin. "Less talk, more eatin'," someone in the back row called, and there was another burst of applause. It was heartier this time.
Mayor Charbonneau handed Sylvia a stopwatch and a silver police whistle, which she would blow at the end of the 10 minutes of the all-out pie-eating. Mayor Charbonneau would then step forward and hold up the hand of the winner. "Are you ready?" His Honor's voice rolled triumphantly through the Great Day PA and off down Main Street. The 5 pie-eaters declared they were ready. "Are you set?" His Honor inquired further. The eaters growled that they were indeed set. Down street, a boy set off a rattling skein of firecrackers. Mayor Charbonneau raised one pudgy hand and then dropped it. "Go!" 5 heads dropped into 5 pie plates. The sound was like 5 large feet stamping firmly into mud. Wet chomping noises rose on the mild night air and then were blotted out as the bettors and partisans in the crowd began to cheer on their favorites. And no more than the first pie had been demolished before most people realized that a possible upset was in the making. Lard Ass Hogan, a 7-to-1 underdog because of his age and inexperience, was eating like a boy possessed. His jaws machine-gunned up crust. The contest rules require that only the top crust of the pie be eaten, not the bottom. And when that had disappeared, a huge sucking sound issued from between his lips. It was like the sound of an industrial vacuum cleaner going to work. Then his whole head disappeared into the pie plate. He raised it 15 seconds later to indicate he was done. His cheeks and forehead were smeared with blueberry juice, and he looked like an extra in a minstrel show. He was done. Done before the legendary Bill Travis had finished half of his first pie. Startled applause went up as the mayor examined Lardass's pie plate and pronounced it clean enough. He whipped a second pie into place before the pacemaker. Lardass had gobbled a regulation-sized pie in just 42 seconds. It was a contest record. He went at the second pie even more furiously yet, his head bobbing and smooching in the soft blueberry filling, and Bill Travis threw him a worried glance as he called for his second blueberry pie. As he told friends later, he felt he was in a real contest for the first time since 1957, when George Gamache gobbled 3 pies in 4 minutes and then fainted dead away. He had to wonder, he said, if he was up against a boy or a demon. He thought of the money he had riding on this and redoubled his efforts. But if Travis had redoubled, Lardass had trebled. Blueberries flew from his second pie dish, staining the tablecloth around him like a Jackson Pollock painting. There were blueberries in his hair, blueberries on his bib, blueberries standing out on his forehead, as if, in an agony of concentration, he had actually begun to sweat blueberries. "Done!" he cried, lifting his head from his second pie dish before Bill Travis had even consumed the crust on his new pie. "Better slow down, boy," His Honor murmured. Charbonneau himself had $10 riding on Bill Travis. "You gotta pace yourself if you want to hold out." It was as if Lardass hadn't heard. He tore into his third pie with lunatic speed, jaws moving with lightning rapidity, and then... But I must interrupt for a moment to tell you that there was an empty bottle in the medicine cabinet at Lardass Hogan's house. Earlier, that bottle had been 3/4 full of pearl-yellow castor oil, perhaps the most noxious fluid that the good Lord in his infinite wisdom ever allowed upon or beneath the face of the earth. Lardass had emptied the bottle himself, drinking every last drop and then licking the rim, his mouth twisting, his belly gagging sourly, his brain filled with thoughts of sweet revenge. And as he rapidly worked his way through his third pie, Calvin Speer, dead last as predicted, had not yet finished his first, Lardass began to deliberately torture himself with grisly fantasies. He was not eating pies at all. He was eating cow flops. He was eating great big gobs of greasy Grammy gopher guts. He was eating diced up woodchuck intestines with blueberry sauce poured over them. Rancid blueberry sauce. He finished his third pie and called for his fourth, now one full pie ahead of the legendary Bill Travis. The fickle crowd, sensing a new and unexpected champ in the making, began to cheer him on lustily. But Lardass had no hope or intention of winning. He could not have continued at the pace he was currently setting if his own mother's life had been the prize. And besides, winning for him was losing. Revenge was the only blue ribbon he sought.
his belly groaning with castor oil, his throat opening and closing sickly. He finished his fourth pie and called for his fifth, the ultimate pie. Blueberries become Electra, so to speak. He dropped his head into the dish, breaking the crust and snuffled blueberries up his nose. Blueberries went down his shirt. The contents of his stomach seemed to suddenly gain weight. He chewed up pasty pastry crust and swallowed it. He inhaled blueberries. And suddenly, the moment of revenge was at hand. His stomach, loaded beyond endurance, revolted. It clenched like a strong hand encased in a slick rubber glove. His throat opened. Lardass raised his head. He grinned at Bill Travis with blue teeth. Puke rumbled up his throat like a 6-ton Peterbilt shooting through a tunnel. It roared out of his mouth in a huge blue and yellow glurt, warm and gaily steaming. It covered Bill Travis, who only had time to utter one nonsense syllable. Goog was what it sounded like. Women in the audience screamed. Calvin Speer, who had watched this unannounced event with a numb and surprised expression on his face, leaned conversationally over the table as if to explain to the gaping audience just what was happening and puked on the head of Marguerite Charbonneau, the mayor's wife. She screamed and backed away, pawing futilely at her hair, which was now covered with a mixture of crushed berries, baked beans, and partially digested frankfurters. The latter two had been Cal Speer's dinner. She turned to her good friend Maria Lavin and threw up on the front of Maria's buckskin jacket. In rapid succession, like a replay of the firecrackers, Bill Travis blew a great and seemingly supercharged jet of vomit out over the first two rows of spectators, his stunned face proclaiming to one and all, "Man, I just can't believe I'm doing this." Chuck Day, who had received a generous portion of Bill Travis's surprise gift, threw up on his hush puppies and then blinked at them wonderingly, knowing full well that stuff would never come off suede. John Wiggins, principal of Gretna Elementary, opened his blue-lined mouth and said reprovingly, "Really, this has..." as befitted a man of his breeding, a position he did it on his own pie plate. His Honor Charbonneau, who found himself suddenly presiding over what must have seemed more like a stomach flu hospital ward than a pie-eating contest, opened his mouth to call the whole thing off and upchucked all over the microphone. "Jesus, save us," moaned Sylvia Dodge, and then her outraged supper, fried clams, coleslaw, butter and sugar, corn, 2 Hearsworth, and a generous helping of Muriel Harrington's Bosco chocolate cake, bolted out the emergency exit and landed with a large wet splash on the back of the mayor's Robert Hall suit coat. Lardass Hogan, now at the absolute apogee of his young life, beamed happily out over the audience. Puke was everywhere. People staggered around in drunken circles, holding their throats and making weak, cawing noises. Somebody's pet Pekingese ran past the stage, yapping crazily, and a man wearing jeans and a Western-style silk shirt threw up on it, nearly drowning it. Mrs. Brockway, the Methodist minister's wife, made a long, basso-belching noise, which was followed by a gusher of degenerated roast beef and mashed potatoes and apple cobbler. The cobbler looked as if it might have been good when it first went down. Jerry Marling, who had come to see his pet mechanic walk away with all the marbles again, decided to get the righteous fuck out of this madhouse. He got about 15 yards before tripping over a kid's little red wagon and realizing he had landed in a puddle of warm bile. Jerry tossed his cookies in his own lap and told folks later he only thanked Providence he had been wearing his coveralls. And Miss Norman, who taught Latin and English fundamentals at the Gretna Consolidated High School, vomited into her own purse in an agony of propriety. Lardass Hogan watched it all, his large face calm and beaming, his stomach suddenly sweet and steady, with a warm balm it might never know again. That balm was a feeling of utter and complete satisfaction. He stood up, took the slightly tacky microphone from the trembling hand of Mayor Charbonneau and said, "I declare this contest a draw." 17. Then he puts the mic down, walks off back of the platform, and goes straight home. His mother's there on account of she couldn't get a babysitter for Lardass's little sister who was only 2. And as soon as he comes in, all covered with puke and pie drool, still wearing his bib, she says, "Davy, did you win?" But he doesn't say a fucking word, you know. He just goes upstairs to his room, locks the door, and lays down on his bed. I downed the last swallow in Chris's Coke and tossed it into the woods.
Yeah, that's cool. Then what happened? Teddy asked eagerly.
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know? Teddy asked. I mean, it's the end. When you don't know what happens next, that's the end.
What?
Vern cried. There was an upset, suspicious look on his face, like he thought maybe he'd just gotten rooked playing penny-up bingo at the Topsham Fair.
What's all this happy-crappy? How'd it come out?
You have to use your imagination, Chris said patiently.
No, I ain't, Vern said angrily. He's supposed to use his imagination. He made up the fucking story.
Yeah, what happened to the cat? Teddy persisted. Come on, Gordy, tell us.
I think his dad was at the Pyete, and when he came home, he beat the living crap out of Lardass.
Yeah, right, Chris said. I bet that's just what happened.
And, I said, the kids went right on calling him Lardass, except that maybe some of them started calling him Puke Your Guts, too.
That ending sucks, Teddy said sadly.
That's why I didn't want to tell it.
You could have made it so he shot his father and ran away and joined the Texas Rangers, Teddy said. How about that?
Chris and I exchanged a glance. Chris raised one shoulder in a barely perceptible shrug.
I guess so, I said.
Hey, you got any new Lidio stories, Gordy?
Not just now. Maybe I'll think of some. I didn't want to upset Teddy, but I wasn't very interested in checking out what was happening in Lidio either. Sorry you didn't go for this one better.
Nah, it was good, Teddy said. Right up to the end, it was good. All that puking was really cool.
Yeah, that was cool. Really gross, Vern agreed.
But Teddy's right about the ending. It was sort of a jip.
Yeah, I said, and sighed.
Chris stood up.
Let's do some walking, he said. It was still bright daylight, the sky a hot, steely blue, but our shadows had begun to trail out long. I remember that as a kid, September days always seemed to end much too soon, catching me by surprise. It was as if something inside my heart expected it to always be June, with daylight lingering in the sky until almost 9:30. What time is it, Gordy? I looked at my watch and was astonished to see it was after 5.
Yeah, let's go, Teddy said. But let's make camp before dark so we can see to get wood and stuff. I'm getting hungry, too.
6:30, Chris promised. Okay with you guys?
It was.
We started to walk again, using the cinders beside the tracks now. Soon the river was so far behind us we couldn't even hear its sound. Mosquitoes hummed and I slapped one off my neck. Vern and Teddy were walking up ahead, working out some sort of complicated comic book trade. Chris was beside me, hands in his pockets, shirt slapping against his knees and thighs like an apron. I got some Winstons, he said. Hawked them off my old man's dresser. One apiece, for after supper.
Yeah, that's boss.
That's when a cigarette tastes best, Chris said. After supper.
Right.
We walked in silence for a while.
That's a really fine story, Chris said suddenly. They're just a little too dumb to understand.
No, it's not that hot. It's a mumbler.
That's what you always say. Don't give me that bullshit you don't believe. You gonna write it down, the story?
Probably, but not for a while. I can't write 'em down right after I tell 'em.
It'll keep.
What Vern said about the ending being a jip,
yeah?
Chris laughed. Life's a jip, you know it? I mean, look at us.
Ah, we have a great time.
Sure, Chris said. All the fucking time, you wet. I laughed.
Chris did, too.
They come out of you just like bubbles out of soda pop, he said after a while.
What does?
But I thought I knew what he meant.
The stories. That really bugs me, man. It's like you could tell a million stories and still only get the ones on top.
You'll be a great writer someday, Gordy.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, you will. Maybe you'll even write about us guys if you ever get hard up for material.
I have to be pretty fucking hard up, I gave him the elbow.
There was another period of silence, and then he asked suddenly, you ready for school?
I shrugged. Whoever was.
You got a little excited thinking about going back, seeing your friends. You were curious about your new teachers and what they would be like. Pretty young things just out of teacher's college that you could rag, or some old topkick that had been there since the Alamo. In a funny way, you could even get excited about the long, droning classes, because as the summer vacation neared its end, you sometimes got bored enough to believe you could learn something. But summer boredom was nothing like the school boredom that always set in by the end of the second week. And by the beginning of the third week, you got down to the real business. Could you hit Stinky Fisk in the back of the head with your art gum while the teacher was putting the principal exports of South America on the board? How many good loud squeaks could you get off on the varnished surface of your desk if your hands were real sweaty?
Who could cut the loudest farts in the locker room while changing up for phys ed? How many girls could you get to play Who Goosed the Moose during lunch hour?
Higher learning, baby.
Junior high, Chris said. And you know what, Gordy? By next June, we'll all be quits.
What are you talking about? Why would that happen?
It's not going to be like grammar school, that's why. You'll be in the college courses. Me and Teddy and Vern will all be in the shop courses, playing pocket pool with the rest of the retards, making ashtrays and birdhouses. Vern might even have to go into remedial. You'll meet a lot of new guys, smart guys. That's just the way it works, Gordy. That's how they got it set up.
Meet a lot of pussies, is what you mean, I said.
He gripped my arm. No, man, don't say that. Don't even think that. They'll get your stories, not like Vern and Teddy. Fuck the stories. I'm not going in with a lot of pussies, no, sir. If you don't, then you're an asshole. What's asshole about wanting to be with your friends? He looked at me thoughtfully, as if deciding whether or not to tell me something. We had slowed down. Vern and Teddy had pulled almost half a mile ahead. The sun, lower now, came at us through the overlacing trees in broken, dusty shafts, turning everything gold. But it was a tawdry gold. Dime store gold, if you can dig that. The tracks stretched ahead of us in the gloom that was just starting to gather. They seemed almost to twinkle. Star pricks of light stood out on them here and there, as if some nutty rich guy, masquerading as a common laborer, had decided to embed a diamond in the steel every 60 yards or so. It was still hot. The sweat rolled off us, slicking our bodies. It's asshole if your friends can drag you down, Chris said finally. I know about you and your folks. They don't give a shit about you. Your big brother was the one they cared about. Like my dad when Frank got thrown into the stockade in Portsmouth. That was when he started always being mad at us other kids and hitting us all the time. Your dad doesn't beat on you, but maybe that's even worse. He's got you asleep. You could tell him you were enrolling in the fucking shop division, and you know what he'd do? He'd turn to the next page in his paper and say, "Well, that's nice, Gordon. Go ask your mother what's for dinner. And don't try to tell me different. I've met him." I didn't try to tell him different. It's scary to find out that someone else, even a friend, knows just how things are with you. You're just a kid, Gordy.
Gee, thanks, Dad.
I wish the fuck I was your father, he said angrily. You wouldn't go around talking about taking those stupid shop courses if I was. It's like God gave you something, all those stories you can make up, and he said, "This is what we got for you, kid. Try not to lose it." But kids lose everything, unless somebody looks out for them. And if your folks are too fucked up to do it, then maybe I ought to. His face looked like he was expecting me to take a swing at him. It was set and unhappy in the green-gold late afternoon light. He had broken the cardinal rule for kids in those days. You could say anything about another kid. You could rank him to the dogs and back, but you didn't say a bad word ever about his mom and dad. That was the fabled automatic. The same way not inviting your Catholic friends home to dinner on Friday unless you checked first to make sure you weren't having meat was the fabled automatic. If a kid ranked out your mom and dad, you had to feed him some knuckles. Those stories you tell, they're no good to anybody but you, Gordy. If you go along with us just because you don't want the gang to break up, you'll wind up just another grunt making C's to get on the teams. You'll get to high and take the same fucking shop courses and throw erasers and pull your meat along with the rest of the grunts. Get detentions, fucking suspensions. And after a while, all you'll care about is getting a car so you can take some skag to the hops or down to the fucking Twin Bridges Tavern. Then you'll knock her up and spend the rest of your life in a mill or some fucking shoe shop in Auburn. Or maybe even up to Hillcrest plucking chickens. And that pie story will never get written down. Nothing will get written down. Because you'll just be another wise guy with shit for brains. Chris Chambers was 12 when he said all that to me. But while he was saying it, his face crumpled and folded into something older, oldest, ageless. He spoke tonelessly, colorlessly, but nevertheless, what he said struck terror into my bowels. It was as if he had lived that whole life already. That life where they tell you to step right up and spin the wheel of fortune. And it spins so pretty, and the guy steps on a pedal, and it comes up double zeros. House number, everybody loses. They give you a free pass, and then they turn on the rain machine. Pretty funny, huh? A joke even Vern Tessio could appreciate.
He grabbed my naked arm, and his fingers closed tight. They dug grooves in my flesh. They ground at the bones. His eyes were hooded and dead. So dead, man, that he might have just fallen out of his own coffin. I know what people think of my family in this town. I know what they think of me and what they expect. Nobody even asked me if I took the milk money that time. I just got a 3-day vacation.
Did you take it? I asked. I had never asked him before. And if you had told me I ever would, I would have called you crazy. The words came out in a little dry bullet.
Yeah, he said. Yeah, I took it. He was silent for a moment, looking ahead at Teddy and Vern.
You knew I took it. Teddy knew. Everybody knew. Even Vern knew, I think.
I started to deny it, and then closed my mouth.
He was right. No matter what I might have said to my mother and father about how a person was supposed to be innocent until proved guilty, I had known.
Then maybe I was sorry and tried to give it back, Chris said.
I stared at him, my eyes widening. You tried to give it back?
Maybe, I said, just maybe. And maybe I took it off to old Lady Simons and told her. And maybe the money was all there, but I got a 3-day vacation anyway, because the money never showed up. And maybe the next week old Lady Simons had this brand new skirt on when she came to school. I stared at Chris, speechless with horror. He smiled at me, but it was a crimped, terrible smile that never touched his eyes.
Just maybe, he said,
but I remember the new skirt. A light brown paisley, sort of full. I remember thinking that it made old Lady Simons look younger, almost pretty.
Chris, how much was that milk money?
Almost $7.
Christ, I whispered.
So just say I stole the milk money, but then old Lady Simons stole it from me. Just suppose I told that story. Me, Chris Chambers, kid brother of Frank Chambers and Eyeball Chambers. You think anybody would have believed it?
No way, I whispered. Jesus Christ.
He smiled his wintry, awful smile. And do you think that bitch would have dared try something like that if it had been one of those douchebags from up on the View that had taken the money?
No, I said.
Yeah. If it had been one of them, Simons would have said, Okay, we'll forget it this time, but we're going to spank your wrist real hard, and if you ever do it again, we'll have to spank both wrists. But me... Well, maybe she had her eye on that skirt for a long time. Anyway, she saw her chance, and she took it. I was a stupid one for even trying to give that money back. But I never thought that a teacher... Oh, who gives a fuck anyway? Why am I even talking about it? He swiped an arm angrily across his eyes, and I realized he was almost crying.
Chris, I said, why don't you go into the college courses? You're smart enough.
They decide all of that in the office. And in their smart little conferences, the teachers, they sit around in this big circle jerk, and all they say is, yeah, right. All they give a fuck about is whether you behaved yourself in grammar school and what the town thinks of your family. All they're deciding is whether or not you'll contaminate all those precious college course douchebags. But maybe I'll try to work myself up. I don't know if I could do it, but I might try. Because I want to get out of Castle Rock and go to college, never see my old man or any of my brothers again. I want to go someplace where nobody knows me and I don't have any black marks against me before I start. But I don't know if I can do it.
Why not?
People. People drag you down.
Who?
I asked, thinking it must mean the teachers or adult monsters like Miss Simons, who had wanted a new skirt, or maybe his brother Eyeball, who hung around with Ace and Billy and Charlie and the rest. Or maybe his own mom and dad. But he said, your friends drag you down, Gordy. Don't you know that? He pointed at Vern and Teddy, who were standing and waiting for us to catch up. They were laughing about something. In fact, Vern was just about busting a gut. Your friends do. They're like drowning guys that are holding onto your legs. You can't save them. You can only drown with them.
Come on, you fucking slow pokes, Vern shouted, still laughing.
Yeah, coming, Chris called, and before I could say anything else, he began to run. I ran too, but he caught up to them before I could catch up to him. 18. We went another mile, and then decided to camp for the night. There was still some daylight left, but nobody really wanted to use it. We were pooped from the scene at the dump and from our scare on the train trestle, but it was more than that. We were in Harlow now, in the woods. Somewhere up ahead was a dead kid, probably mangled and covered with flies. Maggots, too, by this time. Nobody wanted to get too close to him with the night coming on. I had read somewhere, in an Algernon Blackwood story, I think, that a guy's ghost hangs out around his dead body until that body is given a decent Christian burial. And there was no way I wanted to wake up in the night and confront the glowing, disembodied ghost of Ray Brower, moaning and gibbering and floating among the dark and rustling pines. By stopping here, we figured there had to be at least 10 miles between us and him. And, of course, all four of us knew there were no such things as ghosts, but 10 miles seemed just about far enough in case what everybody knew was wrong. Vern, Chris, and Teddy gathered wood and got a modest little campfire going on a bed of cinders. Chris scraped a bare patch all around the fire. The woods were powder dry, and he didn't want to take any chances. While they were doing that, I sharpened some sticks and made what my brother Denny used to call pioneer drumsticks, lumps of hamburger pushed onto the ends of green branches. The three of them laughed and bickered over their woodcraft, which was almost nil. There was a Castle Rock Boy Scout troop, but most of the kids who hung around our vacant lot considered it to be an organization made up mostly of pussies, arguing about whether it was better to cook over flames or over coals, a moot point, we were all too hungry to wait for coals, whether dried moss would work as kindling, what they would do if they used up all the matches before they got the fire to stay lit. Teddy claimed he could make a fire by rubbing two sticks together. Chris claimed he was so full of shit he squeaked. They didn't have to try. Vern got the small pile of twigs and dry moss to catch from the second match. The day was perfectly still, and there was no wind to puff out the light. We all took turns feeding the thin flames until they began to grow stouter on wrist chunks of wood fetched from an old deadfall some 30 yards into the forest. When the flames began to die back a little bit, I stuck the sticks holding the pioneer drumsticks firmly into the ground at an angle over the fire. We sat around watching them as they shimmered and dripped and finally began to brown. Our stomachs made pre-dinner conversation. Unable to wait until they were really cooked, we each took one of them, stuck it in a roll, and yanked the hot stick out of the center. They were charred outside, raw inside, and totally delicious. We wolfed them down and wiped the grease from our mouths with our bare hands. Chris opened his pack and took out a tin Band-Aids box. The pistol was way at the bottom of his pack. He opened it and gave each of us a battered Winston. We lit them with flaming twigs from the fire and then leaned back, men of the world, watching the cigarette smoke drift away into the soft twilight. None of us inhaled because we might cough, and that would mean a day or two of ragging from the others. And it was pleasant enough to just drag and blow, hawking into the fire to hear the sizzle. That was the summer I learned how you can pick out someone who was just learning to smoke. If you're new at it, you spit a lot. We were feeling good. We smoked the Winstons down to the filters, then tossed them into the fire. Nothing like a smoke after a meal, Teddy said. Fucking A, Vern agreed. Crickets had started to hum in the green gloom. I looked up at the lane of sky visible through the railroad cut and saw that the blue was now bruising toward purple. Seeing that outrider of twilight made me feel sad and calm at the same time. Brave, but not really brave. Comfortably lonely. We tromped down a flat place in the underbrush beside the embankment and laid out our bedrolls. Then, for an hour or so, we fed the fire and talked. The kind of talk you can never quite remember once you get past 15 and discover girls. We talked about who was the best dragger in Castle Rock, if Boston could maybe stay out of the cellar this year, and about the summer just past. Teddy told about the time he had been at White's Beach in Brunswick, and some kid had hit his head while diving off the float and almost drowned. We discussed at some length the relative merits of the teachers we had had. We agreed that Mr. Brooks was the biggest pussy in Castle Rock Elementary. He would just about cry if you sassed him back. On the other hand, there was Miss Cody. She was just about the meanest bitch God had ever set down on the earth. Vern said he'd heard she hit a kid so hard 2 years ago that the kid almost went blind. I looked at Chris, wondering if he would say anything about Miss Simons, but he didn't say anything at all.
and he didn't see me looking at him. He was looking at Vern and nodding soberly at Vern's story. We didn't talk about Ray Brower as the dark drew down, but I was thinking about him. There's something horrible and fascinating about the way dark comes to the woods. It's coming unsoftened by headlights or streetlights or house lights or neon. It comes with no mother's voices calling for their kids to leave off and come on in now to herald it. If you're used to the town, the coming of the dark in the woods seems more like a natural disaster than a natural phenomenon. It rises like the Castle River rises in the spring. And as I thought about the body of Ray Brower and this light, or lack of it, what I felt was not queasiness or fear that he would suddenly appear before us a green and gibbering banshee whose purpose was to drive us back the way we had come before we could disturb his its peace, but a sudden and unexpected wash of pity, that he should be so alone and so defenseless in the dark that was now coming over our side of the earth. If something wanted to eat on him, it would. His mother wasn't here to stop that from happening, and neither was his father, nor Jesus Christ in the company of all the saints. He was dead, and he was all alone, flung off the railroad tracks and into the ditch. And I realized that if I didn't stop thinking about it, I was going to cry. So I told a Ladillo story, made up on the spot and not very good. And when it ended, as most of my Ladillo stories did, with one lone American dog face coughing out a dying declaration of patriotism and love for the girl back home into the sad and wise face of the platoon sergeant, it was not the white, scared face of some PFC from Castle Rock or White River Junction I saw in my mind's eye, but the face of a much younger boy, already dead. His eyes closed, his features troubled, a rill of blood running from the left corner of his mouth to his jawline. And in back of him, instead of the shattered shops and churches of my Ladillo dreamscape, I saw only dark forest and a cindered railway bed bulking against the starry sky like a prehistoric burial mound. 19. I came awake in the middle of the night, disoriented, wondering why it was so chilly in my bedroom and who had left the windows open, Denny, maybe. I had been dreaming of Denny, something about body surfing at Harrison State Park. But it had been 4 years ago that we had done that. This wasn't my room, this was someplace else. Somebody was holding me in a mighty bear hug. Somebody else was pressed against my back, and a shadowy third was crouched beside me, head cocked in a listening attitude. "What the fuck?" I asked in honest puzzlement. A long, drawn-out groan in answer. It sounded like Vern. That brought things into focus, and I remembered where I was. But what was everybody doing awake in the middle of the night? Or had I only been asleep for seconds? No, that couldn't be, because a thin sliver of moon was floating dead center in an inky sky. "Don't let it get me," Vern gibbered. "I swear I'll be a good boy. I won't do nothing bad. I'll put the ring up before I take a piss. I'll... With some astonishment, I realized that I was listening to a prayer, or at least the Vern Tessio equivalent of a prayer. I sat bolt upright, scared. "Chris?" "Shut up, Vern," Chris said. He was the one crouching and listening. "It's nothing." "Oh, yes, it is," Teddy said ominously. "It's something." "What is?" I asked. I was still sleepy and disoriented, unstrung from my place in space and time. It scared me that I had come in late on whatever had developed, too late to defend myself properly, maybe. As if to answer my question, a long and hollow scream rose languidly from the woods. It was the sort of scream you might expect from a woman dying in extreme agony and extreme fear. "Oh, dear to Jesus," Vern whimpered, his voice high and filled with tears. He reapplied the bear hug that had awakened me, making it hard for me to breathe and adding to my own terror. I threw him loose with an effort, but he scrambled right back beside me like a puppy which can't think of any place else to go. "It's that Brower kid," Teddy whispered hoarsely. "His ghost's out walking in the woods." "Oh, God," Vern screamed, apparently not crazy about that idea at all. "I promise I won't hawk no more dirty books out of Daly's Market. I promise I won't give my carrots to the dog no more.
I, he floundered there, wanting to bribe God with everything, but unable to think of anything really good in the extremity of his fear. I won't smoke no more unfiltered cigarettes. I won't say no bad swears. I won't put my bazooka on the offering plate. I won't shut up, Vern, Chris said. And beneath his usual authoritative toughness, I could hear the hollow boom of awe. I wondered if his arms and back and belly were as stiff with goose flesh as my own were, and if the hair on the nape of his neck was trying to stand up in hackles as mine was. Vern's voice dropped to a whisper as he continued to expand the reforms he planned to institute, if God would only let him live through this night. It's a bird, isn't it? I asked Chris. No. At least I don't think so. I think it's a wildcat. My dad says they scream bloody murder when they're getting ready to mate. Sounds like a woman, doesn't it? Yeah, I said. My voice hitched in the middle of the word, and two ice cubes broke off in the gap. But no woman could scream that loud, Chris said, then added helplessly, could she, Gordy?
It's his ghost,
Teddy whispered again. His eyeglasses reflected the moonlight in weak, somehow dreamy smears.
I'm going to go look for it.
I don't think he was serious, but we took no chances. When he started to get up, Chris and I hauled him back down. Perhaps we were too rough with him, but our muscles had been turned to cables with fear.
Let me up, fuckheads, Teddy hissed, struggling.
If I say I want to go look for it, then I'm going to go look for it. I want to see it. I want to see the ghost. I want to see if... The wild, sobbing cry rose into the night again, cutting the air like a knife with a crystal blade, freezing us with our hands on Teddy. If he'd been a flag, we would have looked like that picture of the Marines claiming Iwo Jima. The scream climbed with a crazy ease through octave after octave, finally reaching a glassy, freezing edge. It hung there for a moment and then whirled back down again, disappearing into an impossible bass register that buzzed like a monstrous honeybee. This was followed by a burst of what sounded like mad laughter, and then there was silence again.
Jesus H. Bald-headed Christ, Teddy whispered.
And he talked no more of going into the woods to see what was making that screaming noise. All four of us huddled up together, and I thought of running. I doubt if I was the only one. If we'd been tenting in Vern's field, where our folks thought we were, we probably would have run. But Castle Rock was too far, and the thought of trying to run across that trestle in the dark made my blood freeze. Running deeper into Harlow and closer to the corpse of Ray Brower was equally unthinkable. We were stuck. If there was a haunt out there in the woods, what my dad called a goosalem, and it wanted us, it would probably get us. Chris proposed we keep a guard, and everyone was agreeable to that. We flipped her watches, and Vern got the first one. I got the last. Vern sat up cross-legged by the husk of the campfire while the rest of us lay down again. We huddled together like sheep. I was positive that sleep would be impossible. But I did sleep, a light, uneasy sleep that skimmed through unconsciousness like a sub with its periscope up. My half-sleeping dreams were populated with wild cries that might have been real or might have been only products of my imagination. I saw, or thought I saw, something white and shapeless steal through the trees, like a grotesquely ambulatory bedsheet. At last I slipped into something I knew was a dream. Chris and I were swimming at White's Beach, a gravel pit in Brunswick that had been turned into a miniature lake when the gravel diggers struck water. It was where Teddy had seen the kid hit his head and almost drown. In my dream, we were out over our heads, stroking lazily along with a hot July sun blazing down. From behind us on the float came cries and shouts and yells of laughter as kids climbed and dived or climbed and were pushed. I could hear the empty kerosene drums that held the float up clanging and booming together, a sound not unlike that of church bells, which are so solemn and emptily profound. On the sand and gravel beach, oiled bodies lay face down on blankets, little kids with buckets squatted on the verge of the water or sat happily flipping muck into their hair with plastic shovels, and teenagers clustered in grinning groups watching the young girls promenade endlessly back and forth in pairs and trios. Never alone, the secret places of their bodies wrapped in Jansen tank suits. People walked up the hot sand on the balls of their feet, wincing to the snack bar. They came back with chips, devil dogs, red ball, popsicles.
Mrs. Cody drifted past us on an inflatable rubber raft. She was lying on her back, dressed in her typical September to June school uniform, a gray two-piece suit with a thick sweater instead of a blouse under the jacket, a flower pinned over one almost non-existent breast, thick support hose the color of Canada mints on her legs. Her black old lady's high-heeled shoes were trailing in the water, making small V's. Her hair was blue-rinsed like my mother's and done up in those tight, medicinal-smelling clock-spring curls. Her glasses flashed brutally in the sun. "Watch your steps, boys," she said. "Watch your steps, or I'll hit you hard enough to strike you blind. I can do that. I have been given that power by the school board. Now, Mr. Chambers, mending wall, if you please, by rote."
"I tried to give the money back," Chris said.
"Old Lady Simon said okay, but she took it. Do you hear me? She took it. Now what are you going to do about it? Are you going to whack her blind?" "Mending wall, Mr. Chambers, if you please, by rote."
Chris threw me a despairing glance as if to say, "Didn't I tell you it would be this way?" and then began to tread water. He began, "Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen ground swell under it," and then his head went under, his reciting mouth filling with water. He popped back up, crying, "Help me, Gordy! Help me!" Then he was dragged under again. Looking into the clear water, I could see two bloated, naked corpses holding his ankles. One was Vern, and the other was Teddy, and their open eyes were as blank and pupil-less as the eyes of Greek statues. Their small, prepubescent penises floated limply up from their distended bellies like albino strands of kelp. Chris's head broke water again. He held one hand up limply to me and voiced a screaming, womanish cry that rose and rose, ululating in the hot, sunny summer air. I looked wildly toward the beach, but nobody had heard. The lifeguard, his bronzed, athletic body lolling attractively on the seat at the top of his whitewashed, cruciform wooden tower, just went on smiling down at a girl in a red bathing suit. Chris's scream turned into a bubbling, water-choked gurgle as the corpses pulled him under again, and as they dragged him down to black water, I could see his rippling, distorted eyes turned up to me in a pleading agony. I could see his white, starfish hands held helplessly up to the sun-burnished roof of the water. But instead of diving down and trying to save him, I stroked madly for the shore, or at least to a place where the water would not be over my head. Before I could get there, before I could even get close, I felt a soft, rotted, implacable hand wrap itself around my calf and begin to pull. A scream built up in my chest, but before I could utter it, the dream washed away into a grainy facsimile of reality. It was Teddy, with his hand on my leg. He was shaking me awake. It was my watch. Still half in the dream, almost talking in my sleep, I asked him thickly, "You alive, Teddy?" "No, I'm dead, and you're a black nigger," he said crossly. It dispelled the last of the dream. I sat up by the campfire, and Teddy lay down. 20. The others slept heavily through the rest of the night. I was in and out, dozing, waking, dozing again. The night was far from silent. I heard the triumphant screech squawk of a pouncing owl, the tiny cry of some small animal, perhaps about to be eaten, a larger something blundering wildly through the undergrowth. Under all of this, a steady tone, were the crickets. There were no more screams. I dozed and woke, woke and dozed, and I suppose if I had been discovered standing such a slipshod watch in Lidio, I probably would have been court-martialed and shot. I snapped more solidly out of my last doze and became aware that something was different. It took a moment or two to figure it out. Although the moon was down, I could see my hands resting on my jeans. My watch said 4:45. It was dawn. I stood, hearing my spine crackle, walked 24 feet away from the lumped-together bodies of my friends, and pissed into a clump of sumac. I was starting to shake the night willies. I could feel them sliding away. It was a fine feeling. I scrambled up the cinders to the railroad tracks and sat on one of the rails, idly chucking cinders between my feet, in no hurry to wake the others. At that precise moment, the new day felt too good to share. Morning came on apace. The noise of the crickets began to drop, and the shadows under the trees and bushes evaporated like puddles after a shower. The air had that peculiar lack of taste that presages the latest hot day in a famous series of hot days.
Birds that had maybe cowered all night just as we had done now began to twitter, self-importantly. A wren landed on top of the deadfall from which we had taken our firewood, preened itself, and then flew off. I don't know how long I sat there on the rail, watching the purple steal out of the sky as noiselessly as it had stolen in the evening before. Long enough for my butt to start complaining, anyway. I was about to get up when I looked to my right and saw a deer standing in the railroad bed, not 10 yards from me. My heart went up into my throat so high that I think I could have put my hand in my mouth and touched it. My stomach and genitals filled with a hot, dry excitement. I didn't move. I couldn't have moved if I'd wanted to. Her eyes weren't brown, but a dark, dusty black, the kind of velvet you see backgrounding jewelry displays. Her small ears were scuffed suede. She looked serenely at me, head slightly lowered in what I took for curiosity, seeing a kid with his hair in a sleep scarecrow of whorls and many-tined cowlicks, wearing jeans with cuffs and a brown khaki shirt with elbows mended, and the collar turned up in the hoodie tradition of the day. What I was seeing was some sort of gift, something given with a carelessness that was appalling. We looked at each other for a long time. I think it was a long time. Then she turned and walked off to the other side of the tracks, white bobtail flipping insouciantly. She found grass and began to crop. I couldn't believe it. She had begun to crop. She didn't look back at me, and didn't need to. I was frozen solid. Then the rails started to thrum under my ass, and bare seconds later the doe's head came up, cocked back toward Castle Rock. She stood there, her branch-black nose working on the air, coaxing it a little. Then she was gone, in 3 gangling leaps, vanishing into the woods with no sound but 1 rotted branch, which broke with a sound like a track ref starter gun. I sat there, looking mesmerized at the spot where she had been, until the actual sound of the freight came up through the stillness. Then I skidded back down the bank to where the others were sleeping. The freight's slow, loud passage woke them up, yawning and scratching. There was some funny, nervous talk about the case of the screaming ghost, as Chris called it, but not as much as you might imagine. In daylight, it seemed more foolish than interesting, almost embarrassing, best forgotten. It was on the tip of my tongue to tell them about the deer, but I ended up not doing it. That was one thing I kept to myself. I've never spoken or written of it until just now, today. And I have to tell you that it seems a lesser thing written down, damn near inconsequential. But for me, it was the best part of that trip, the cleanest part. And it was a moment I found myself returning to, almost helplessly, when there was trouble in my life. My first day in the bush in Vietnam, and this fellow walked into the clearing where we were with his hand over his nose. And when he took his hand away, there was no nose there because it had been shot off. The time the doctor told us our youngest son might be hydrocephalic. He turned out to just have an oversized head, thank God. The long, crazy weeks before my mother died, I would find my thoughts turning back to that morning, the scuffed suede of her ears, the white flash of her tail. But 800 million red Chinese don't give a shit, right? The most important things are the hardest to say, because words diminish them. It's hard to make strangers care about the good things in your life.